luce.
I'm sure we do actually have a representative number of members.
We do have, Chair. We can proceed. We do, correct. So we may proceed with proceedings, Chair.
Okay, let's take the quick roll call.
I'll do so, Chair. Mr. Mbuyane, Chair.
Honorable Mbuyane.
Recording in progress.
Chairperson, good morning. Good morning to colleagues. I'm present. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Chair, Mrs. Hemmings, Chair.
Honorable Hemmings.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, everyone on the platform.
Morning, morning, Chair. Morning.
Mr. Cuthbert, Chair.
Honorable Cuthbert.
Morning, Chairperson, and also please, if you could note the apology of Mr. McPherson, he's currently on a flight to Cape Town.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Chair, Ms. Yaku, Chair.
Honorable Yaku.
Morning, Chair, morning, everybody. I'm present.
Good morning. Welcome.
Chair, Ms. Mwatse, Chair.
Yes,
Honorable Mwatse.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, colleagues. I'm present.
Thank you. Good morning.
Chair, Mr. Thring, Chair.
Honorable Thring.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, colleagues. Chair, please note that I may have to leave at around 10. I'm still on oversight visit in the Northern Cape. The public works infrastructure. Thank you, Chair.
We'll note the apology. Thank you, Honorable Thring. Good morning.
Chair, Mr. Mulder, Chair.
Honorable Mulder.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, colleagues. I'm present.
Good morning. Hoyamore.
Just Ms. Mutohan indicated that she will join the committee a bit later, Chair. And okay. I will follow up with Mr. Burns Namashi. He may have some connectivity challenges, Chair, or if there's an apology. I'm not aware of yet, but we will contact Mr. Biz Mamashe to assist him if he has that challenge, Chair.
Okay. Let's actually then go and fly to the program. We've got a few of apologies which we need to note on record, and then maybe we can actually have our agenda presented before us. On the apologies, I think we can actually do that confirmation of those that have come through. Let's check if there are any other apologies that were not mentioned. And if ever there are none, let's note those that were actually raised now when we are greeting members. And then we can actually, then we can look at the agenda. So there are no extra ones, Secretaries?
Not at the moment, Chair.
Okay. Let's actually then before the members put the program, honorable members, we do actually have the briefing by the department. And obviously we will actually be looking at the NEF and the IDC in terms of the economic recovery interventions. And then we actually do have the other presentation briefing by SASRIA. In terms of actually its mandate, functions, and operations. And obviously there's actually going to be the consideration of the amended committee program, because in terms of the parliamentary program and other related issues, we'll need to actually make sure that we update our program to ensure that our presentations actually are covered. So let's actually ask members to assist if ever there's any comments or in terms of the acceptance, the three items we have on our agenda, briefing DTIC, SASRIA, and the consideration of amended committee program.
Chair, we have Mrs. Hemmings, followed by Mr. Mbuyane's hand raised, Chair.
Honorable Hemmings.
I propose adoption of the agenda as table, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hemmings. Mbuyane, Honorable Mbuyane.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I support the proposal. Thank you.
We can just check if there's any objection. If not, can we then, Secretariat, proceed to pick up on the next part of the program? Because obviously we will actually have the representation from the department and the entities.
Correct, Chair. We the first item is will be led by the Minister Patel, Chair, and he may introduce this full delegation or part as he wish, Chair. So we can proceed, Chair.
No, I think one would actually then greet the Minister. And actually, quite obviously, Minister, I can see that there is actually the own team of the DTIC, the IDC, and the NEF. And let me actually just welcome you, Minister, and actually the Deputy Minister as well, and then give you the floor to be able to actually take us through the presentation, which was circulated later yesterday. And then we actually can give you the floor. Honourable Minister?
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and a warm good morning to you, to the honourable members of the committee, to the staff of Parliament, as well as to the public representatives that may be monitoring the proceedings. Chairperson, I'd also like to briefly introduce the team. We decided to have a team of people to hear the feedback in the course of the discussion from parliamentarians who have doing the oversight work on the department, the IDC and the NEF. So I am joined by Deputy Minister Majola as well as the Acting Director General Malebo Mabichi Thompson. And we have a team from the department made up of team members that I think the committee would be familiar with: Susan Mangole, Stephen Hannibal, Tanya van Mielis, Eunice Hussain, and Mauto Molefani. They all hit key areas of work in the DTIC. I'm also joined by the chairperson of the IDC, Ms. Busi Mabuza, and the CEO, TP Nchocho, and the IDC has also assembled a senior team of Joanne Bates, the COO, David Jarvis, Stepo Ramodibe, and Gerald Kinanitsana. From the NEF, we joined by the chairperson, Akesh Garash, and the CEO, Pilisiwe Mtetwa. And they've also included a team of people from Mr. Mulepo, Daimani, Ms. Kanile, Mr. Nyembe, Ms. Mzolo, and Mr. Stemela. So the team is here really to reinforce the message of what we're doing, and we are also joined by Deputy Minister Gina. So that's the team, Chair, and first I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to report back to the members of Parliament on the work that the department and the entities have done. Chairperson, we will have one presentation, but I will call on the Director General as well as the leadership of the IDC and NEF to speak two particular slides, because we're working on an integrated approach where the DTIC family or DTIC group can coordinate very actively on the work that it does, and this is a good opportunity to do so. So with that, Chair, the work that we've done on the economic recovery is set out in a presentation. We'll run fairly quickly through some of the slides, but would be available to talk through the issues. I'm going to ask if Sulu Moshi can just share the presentation, and hope that all the members are able to see it. If we go to the first slide, Chairperson, in the work that we're going to do, we're really going to focus on four areas. I would want to make some broader remarks that pull together some of the work of the DCIC and the two entities. The Director General will then talk through specific elements of the department's response. She'll be elaborating a little bit. And then we will have the IDC and NEF teams thereafter making some remarks and taking the committee through a few of the slides. If we go to the next slide, this is really the start of the overview, and honourable members would be very familiar with the context that we had widespread unrest and looting, as well as serious damage to businesses in parts of KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. This is the principal area where we had the challenge. It resulted in the loss of many lives. It undermined business and consumer confidence. It caused very significant damage to property. It was highly coordinated. It was not a spontaneous challenge, but a highly coordinated one. It disrupted supply chains, and it caused loss of business to many firms. The DTIC group developed an integrated response that included working very closely with the Department of Small Business Development and other departments of state at national level, and we worked with the provinces of KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng and a number of metros and district municipalities. There were about 18 separate actions that we thought we should identify and report to the committee on that represented the overall response of the DTIC and its entities, and these can best be summarized in the following two slides. So the first point is, as the unrest started, we created the channel of communication between firms, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, and the security services. The department ran a phone bank, taking and making calls, setting up an email hotline for affected firms, and alerting the security forces to either impending or actual unrest action. We held virtual meetings with firms affected and with business associations to mobilize efforts to counter the threats to persons and property. In a number of cases, it helped to coordinate information between companies in the same area, and it allowed us to coordinate those responses by businesses working with the department. Third, within government, we put in effort to reopen the N3 artery between Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal, to reopen the ports and to secure key secondary roads. One of the immediate challenges we had was the extent to which critical infrastructure had been closed down in the early days of the unrest. The fourth was, we undertook site visits to industrial areas, to affected firms, to distribution centers, and to shopping malls. Next, we met with community and other leaders and visited the communities affected. We also addressed meetings of trade unions and shop stewards. We conducted a survey across industries to determine the level of damage so that we can develop appropriate support measures to assist companies, and we'll talk more through that. We worked with key supply chains to secure the flow of food and medicine and enable retailers to restock their distribution centers and stores. And we addressed the concerns of neighboring countries that there may be disruptions to the flow of goods to neighboring countries, and enabled and ensured that there's a flow of information and that challenges that they anticipated or were concerned with were addressed. Next, on the following slide, we identified alternative suppliers where a KZN-based factory, for example, was damaged, so that the integrated supply chains that represent the South African economy was as little disrupted as possible. We supported companies to unblock challenges to get production and distribution working again, and the DG will talk through the work of Invest South Africa in that regard. We developed an economic recovery fund with 3.7 billion rand earmarked and announced shortly after the law and order had been established in KwaZulu-Natal and the affected parts of Gauteng. We contributed to develop the broader 38 billion rand relief package announced by the Minister of Finance. We supported efforts to get food and medical supplies to communities in distress from charities working with the Department of Social Development and approaching the Solidarity Fund, who did some sterling work to get food and medicines to affected communities. Some of the work that the officials did was to mobilize support from the private sector for smaller businesses that were affected. The department collected data from business groups and did an economic modeling exercise to look at the impact of the looting and the damage, as well as the relief package on the economy. The ministry gazetted exemptions to the Competition Act to enable businesses to coordinate their efforts to secure food, medicine, and essential goods. ITAC published a special rebate facility that enabled manufacturers whose businesses were damaged to import free of duty those goods not available locally, subject to certain commitments on rebuilding their businesses locally. And finally, we engaged international investors on their concerns regarding security, stability, and safety of personnel. But many of them saw the television images and were, of course, concerned about the immediate impact on safety of personnel and the security of their premises, but also the longer-term storyline on investment. So these are 18 broad areas that we've identified. There were a few other smaller interventions, but this is where the bulk of the effort of the department and the agencies went. On the next slide, we recall that we did a range of things to quantify the extent of the damage. Part of it was a self-reporting survey of businesses by the DTIC. There were estimates by the SA Property Owners Association, and we engaged them on updated data based on their member feedback, and we had access to the projections by the South African Council of Shopping Centres. We'll share with the committee what these results show. They vary somewhat. The samples were different. Some of the data is based on actual damage, while others are based on a worst-case scenario, where companies were asked to project over a longer period what would happen if there was not an immediate return to stability and business. The next slide set out the first of these surveys. It was an online survey launched by the DTIC on the 18th of July, with information requested on the impact of the unrest and the potential support required by affected companies. We had a significant turnout, more than 1,000 businesses responded. 67% of respondents were from KwaZulu-Natal and 33% from Gauteng. 59% of the respondents had insurance. We'll unpack this a little bit more. But critically is that most of the businesses who responded were impacted by the unrest. Some were not, which is why I spoke of more than 1,000, but 991 businesses were impacted. We asked them the question, what do you estimate to be the cost of the damage to your physical premises, stock, machinery, and so on? And the initial estimate they had was of the order of 6 billion, 5.8 billion to be precise. Now, of course, some of these were very early estimates, literally days after a company saw its premises disrupted. And in some cases, I'm sure those businesses would have revised their figures either upward or downward. We then asked them the question, what do you anticipate would be the lost orders over the next 12 months? And some companies made the assumption that conditions for returning to normal business would not be in place for many, many months. And based on that, they estimated a loss over a 12-month period. Others took the view that they could get back to business. They anticipated that there would not be a recurrence of this. And so the estimates vary on exactly what people were measuring. But if we take the worst-case scenario, if none of those businesses could recover and all of them were down for a 12-month period, the estimate was that the damage could be as high as 22.8 billion rand. Some of that damage has been mitigated, or loss of orders has been mitigated by the efforts that businesses took to get back on their feet. And again, if nothing was done, the potential job losses of the sample of 991 companies was that as many as 10,300 jobs, 10,400 jobs could potentially be lost. And at the bottom of that slide, it's broken down into the three main categories that we measured, which was manufacturing, retail, and a range of services. Go to the next slide. It just breaks up the data a little bit more. Here we take all of the respondents, not just the respondents that were directly affected by the damage. So there was about 1,200 respondents, and honorable members will see it was roughly three-quarters KZN and one-quarter Gauteng. And the data indicated that 43% of our sample had insurance and 57% did not have insurance. And this was based on a sample of about 675. We've broken down that a little bit more, which and it covers the insured by district, municipality, or metro, and the uninsured. And we can see the concentration of uninsured in critical areas. The next slide will show a second survey. This is by the South African Property Owners Association. They updated their data through the period, and by the 2nd of August, their data showed that there were 100 malls that had significant damage, like fire damage or individual shops where there was attempted arson, and 112 shopping centers had looting or damage. They gave information on the ATMs destroyed on 1,223, the bank branches damaged, the retail stores, the individual stores in those various areas that were damaged or impacted. And some of those were physically damaged. It's 1,787. And others had various forms of looting, 3,931 retail stores. 90 pharmacies were destroyed beyond revival, meaning they couldn't just simply replace the doors or the glass windows and clean up. There was more serious damage that required some significant extensive refurbishing. communication infrastructure was damaged. They also broke down physical damage in KwaZulu-Natal with warehouses, factories, schools, delivery trucks, stock looted, and the impact on the KZN GDP. And of course, this was reporting by the members. We haven't been able to yet collect the final data that will come from the SASRIA assessments and further work that will be done. But there's also a useful graphic on the right-hand side that illustrates the breakdown of the retail stores by major retailer, and honorable members will see the number of stores for each of the big retail chains. The next slide will show a third survey, the South African Council on Shopping Centres, and they looked at the square meterage of lettable areas that has been affected, and they broke it down into province. They also had some detail of three shopping centers in Mpumalanga that had reported damage. And so they were the one survey that also covered Mpumalanga, and they broke down the detail for Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal in a bit more granular detail, and is yet another snapshot. And they indicated more than 1.8 million gross lettable area, square meters of gross lettable area had been affected. The next slide was a number of site visits that were undertaken. These site visits were undertaken by a range of people. We had officials from the IDC and the NEF doing site visits. The DTIC put a team in the field. We had ministry teams, deputy ministers, and myself. We had, in some cases, technical teams. We arranged, for example, that an engineer visit some of the sites. And these photos here just show pictures from clothing factories in Isithebe. The next slide will show retail space in both KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. The next slide will show industrial sites in Pinetown that were burnt down. Some of these looked like they were hit by a bomb, by just the sheer physical damage that was there. The next slide gives an indication of some of the areas that were visited. There was a significant number. They range from Isithebe, Mandeni, Canelands, Pinetown, New Germany, Kwanongoma, and there's a long list, not only in KwaZulu-Natal, but honorable members will see that it also included Gauteng areas, Soweto, Mamelodi, the Everton Mall, and Sebokeng. And these site visits were complemented with virtual meetings and telecalls to provide more detailed feedback from affected businesses or to gain practical insights on the relief needed. The next slide will show the economic impact on the production side of the economy. So we took all of this information we got from different sources, and we ran the numbers, and we concluded that the production side of the economy was significantly affected, although it was temporary, but it's quite significant. And the pace of reconstruction of affected firms will vary, and there are a number of factors. We indicate there the factors like extent of damage, access to capital, business prospects, and so on. We anticipate most of the production effects will be temporary. There are indications that some operations may not resume, and that's an area of focus now. We looked at non-insured businesses as well as insured businesses, and most businesses anticipate that their resumption would be resumption of operations would be within a 3-month period. Many businesses have got back into full operation, but a number of others are still battling. And in the boxes, we provide a greater level of detail on the production activities affected. Honorable members will see there the manufacturing sector heavily affected: food, clothing and textiles, high tech, steel, mineral fabrication, farming, and we'll come separately to that. Many services from retailers, which include spas, shops and bakeries, to professional medical services like opticians, restaurants and fast food services, internet cafes, financial services, vehicle dealers, wholesale and distribution centers, all of these were affected. And there was very significant supply chain disruptions. Transport and logistics was a key area, with trucks and other vehicles destroyed. There was temporary disruptions at port activities, and key transport routes were affected temporarily. The next slide looks at it from the expenditure side of the economy, and their household consumption and fixed investment spending are the most significantly affected. Exports and imports were affected for a limited period. Many businesses ran down the inventories, which will now be followed by rebuilding. There's a reduced household spending where workers are temporarily without work, consumer confidence has been dented, and investment activity has been affected, with business and investment confidence affected, as is certain investment plans may well be postponed or reconsidered, and we're working with companies on that. The next slide is just to make the point that it's not only manufacturing and retail, although these took the hardest hit, but there were 135 farms who suffered extensive economic damage through the burning of sugar cane. These small-scale farmers supplied 5 mills, and we give the areas there. And it affected about 135,000 tons of sugar that were rejected for processing due to fire damage. The estimated loss is 85 million, and we anticipate it could be as many as 8,000 workers. That is what one of the estimates indicate. The farmers have requested financial support, mainly in the form of grants, and the IDC is currently engaged with the farmers to consider and identify ways to assist. The next slide is a result from the DTIC survey. And we asked companies, how long do you anticipate it will take you to get back to a full operation? And I put a little health warning to the slide, that the information was given to us in some cases immediately after the damage, literally within days of a factory being burned down or a retail shop being looted. And many businesses were, of course, not really able to give a good sense of it. So the estimates may well be affected by that, and it could well be that in some cases we could do better, and in other cases businesses may find that it's even more difficult to get together and get their businesses operating again. So if we take insured and uninsured, in other words, the sample of businesses that responded to this question, 25% told us it will take less than a month. In some cases, 2-3 days. In other cases, a week or so. But about a quarter said less than a month. 35% said 1 to 3 months. 16% 3 to 5 months. A similar number, 5 months to a year. And 8% said it could take more than a year. And then we break it down into insured and uninsured. The next slide will on the South African economy is likely to be considerable. The estimate of the cost of the economy has varied widely. Some consultants have put it as high as 50 billion rand, in Etiquini alone, the damage to property and equipment has been estimated to be about 15 billion rand, but more of these figures will be revised as we get quality information, particularly from the Sasria process, because while it would cover principally insured businesses, it will give us an objective baseline of damage. Sentiment among consumers, business, investors have been adversely impacted, and this is anticipated to also affect GDP growth, and there are a range of estimates. At this stage, it's too early to have a reliable estimate, but we thought we would just share with the committee what is currently, or certainly over the last few weeks, have been the range of estimates. The next slide addresses the package of support valued at 38.9 billion rand. A significant part has been the extension of the social relief of distress grant, the extension of the temporary employer-employee relief scheme, what is now known as TERS, the deferrals of certain taxes and the expansion of the tax incentives, and of course the economic rebuilding package by the DTIC Group and the Department of Small Business Development, and some resources are being mobilized from the private sector. The next slide is an exercise that we had done where to the top left-hand corner in the yellow line, honorable members will see the original forecast of household consumption expenditure, and the blue line was what we anticipate would be the impact if we had not stepped in with the support package, and the red line is what we anticipate is the impact of the package. If we can get the package moving quicker, we may be able to lift the red line further, but that gives an indication of the impact on consumption expenditure. At the bottom is the impact on investment expenditure. The yellow line is the original trend. The blue is what we anticipate would happen had we not put a support package in, and the red line is how the support package is assisting. The reason we've put this in is to indicate that when you have a shock to the system of this magnitude, then even a relief package that is put in cannot completely cover the gap, and it takes time for that gap to be addressed. And by quarter four in 2021, the gap between the revised forecast and the April original forecast could be as high as 53 billion rand on the investment side. We hope we can narrow this gap, that we can work more with businesses. We've had one or two really good examples of this happening, but if we slow down our progress too much, then the gap will be wider. If we speed it up and we can get a rebuilding rapidly, then we can reduce that gap. We've also put in some GDP growth estimates on the slide. The next slide will show the elements of the DTIC Group's financial package, 700 million rand reprioritized by the DTIC, 1.3 billion rand that is an additional allocation in the budget internal budget process within government. The IDC has also reprioritized and allocated 1.5 billion rand of resources to the financial package, and the NEF has allocated resources both from its balance sheet and from partner support through the UIF and its work with transport and tourism, and it anticipates that to be 250 million rand. Now, that's raising the money. How will the money be spent? There's a number of different components. Generally speaking, the agencies of the DTIC, that's the IDC and the NEF, are looking at blended products. A blended product would be one where there is a portion of different kinds of support. In some instances, it may only be one form, but generally, the attempt is to try to blend these. There will be a grant portion. Grants are not repayable, so in other words, it is paid over to the business. There may be some conditions put to it, and it's typically based on the need of the business or certain developmental objectives being achieved. For example, maintaining employment and so on. There's a loan component, and these loans are granted at concessionary terms, and it's typically used for working capital, for machinery, for repairs to premises, and for fitment replacement. There's also the use of bridging finance, and this is really money to cover the cash flow challenge that a business has until insurance payouts are made. The next slide will show some risks that we're seeking to mitigate. The first risk is that our pipeline may be too small due to poor communication of our package. Typically, a package takes a long time, and I'll come back to that later. But we've now used new ways of reaching clients, including site and area visits. Normally, the DTIC group would advertise what we have available on our website and through public statements. But now, increasingly, it's getting people moving to affected areas and letting businesses know what is available. Another risk is slow approvals due to red tape. I'll come to the detail of it, but we are looking at the approval processes, and early on we recognize it's going to be one of the key challenges we must manage. Businesses may have a reluctance to take on debt, given both uncertainty in their own business environment, as well as the depletion of the asset base of the company. And we've looked here at conditional grant funding, a portion of the support with concessionary terms for loans. In other words, we've tried to sweeten it to take into account that businesses may not want to take on ordinary debt. There's the potential for corruption and fraudulent claims. It's one of the most disappointing outcomes of last year's COVID interventions, that we saw a number of instances of corruption or alleged corruption, and in an example where we need to move fast, where we need to rapidly deploy resources, one real risk that we need to be aware of and mitigate is the risk of corruption. On the other side of the coin is the risk of fraudulent claims, where businesses could be tempted to overstate the extent of their loss, and it's to ensure that neither of these take place. So to mitigate this, one of the things has been to, we don't want to abandon due diligence, but it's to develop faster methods of due diligence. And the agencies are trying different things now. In some cases, I think they're getting it right. In other cases, we don't think we were quite there in getting the necessary balance between speed and due diligence. And there are more steps being taken to know your client. For example, to check the extent to which the client complies with various laws and so on, just to have a better understanding of who the clients are. We will have to focus on specific anti-corruption measures, a DTIC email hotline that we want to publicize, and real-time audits, audits that take place during the period when we are putting these measures in place and disbursements are being effected, rather than waiting for the end of the financial year. And the Auditor General can also assist in this. This won't replace the annual audit, but it gives us immediately information and it makes everybody aware that there will be oversight. Above all, what we want to do is to have openness perhaps I can also make that point around double dipping and enrichment, where affected firms may well be able to tap into multiple sources at local level, at provincial level, from SASRIA and from the DTIC. And so to mitigate this, we've emphasized the importance of partnerships across the state with open accounting and disclosure systems. Every company that gets even a limited support, any support financially from the state, we should be absolutely open about the company and the details of the company. And transparency is going to be an important complement to the other anti-corruption measures. Finally, there's the risk of limited resources, that we just don't have the amount of money that we ideally would have liked to have. And so to mitigate that, there is going to be, and steps have been taken to ensure greater coordination between what SASRIA can do and what the DTIC group is able to do. And the DG has met with the leadership of SASRIA, and I think there's been some good innovations there. And we want to combine financial and non-financial support. For example, Invest SA has assisted some companies where there is no need for us to give financial support, but just by unblocking some of the challenges, and DG will speak to that later, those companies have been supported. So it's really widening the toolbox beyond only the financial resources. The next slide will then look at the status of applications to date. Of the applications that have been approved, the IDC has 9 for an amount of 150 million rand. The NAF has 18 for 112 million rand, and that gives us 27 applications. But in a number of cases, the applications are for more than one business. It's either a group of businesses have coordinated their application, or there's a franchise with many separate owners, or there could be an owner that has multiple sites and have put in a single claim. So if we take the separate shops or factories or businesses affected, there are 63 that have been approved, and that amounts to 262 million rand. Under consideration, the NEF has 15 transactions that it is considering this week worth 63 million rand. Applications that are under due diligence in that process at the moment, the IDC has 9 for the amount of 349 million rand. The NEF 23 for 318 million rand. And these account for some 667 million rand in total. And they have multiple sites. They cover about 222 separate sites. There are a number of inquiries where businesses have approached the IDC or the NEF, or our agencies have approached businesses that they've seen have incurred damage, and these are now being screened. Some of them are at different stages of a screening process, and you see the numbers there, 93 for the IDC, 41 for the NEF, and that amounts to a further 134 applications for probably an estimate of 1.56 billion rand. Of course, the rand value will become more clear as these inquiries move testing to due diligence, from screening to due diligence. In all the 27 applications that have been approved, covers, as I've indicated, 63 sites with 3,800 workers whose jobs will be saved or supported. These 63 sites don't include businesses that are members of a National Stockpile Association, because it will depend on the number of those stockpile members that are supported. In addition to that, the IDC is in the process of considering rescheduling 9 existing clients affected by the unrest with a facility worth 42 million rand. It's engaging the sugar industry. There's a partnership with Gauteng for 50 million rand allocation to the Gauteng Propeller Fund, and the DTIC is finalizing at this stage, estimated 600 million rand proposal for rebuilding of critical infrastructure damaged during the unrest. This would be typically your facilities in industrial areas. The next slide is really the concluding observations from my part, and I start with sharing with the committee the context that financial support typically in normal circumstances is rolled out following extensive discussion and careful planning. State normally does this before the start of a financial year. The programs are then announced and entities then open their websites for applications. Those then normally go through processes that have been approved by the governing structures, the boards of the two entities. And there's typically a very clear separation between the role of an applicant and their responsibility and that of the approving agencies. So while the agencies try to be helpful, they've generally left a lot of the detailed work traditionally to the applicant to put together. The challenge we face is that the unrest, which includes looting, arson, and willful damage, created a context very similar to what you'd find in a physical conflict zone or a natural disaster, like conditions that you typically have in a society where there's war or some massive disaster. And in those cases, they require rapid action. And the rapid action by agencies is constrained by the fact that applicants have limited resources. A factory may find that all of its records have been burnt and damaged, or its computers have been stolen, which contains much of the financial and other information in it. It's a slow and tedious task to rebuild the records of a company, and in some cases it can't be done fully in the periods it's required. And so faced with these unusual circumstances, the DTIC, IDC, and NEF made some initial innovations. And we'll talk through those, and further adjustments are being put in place. We divide the work into 4 phases. The first phase, immediately as the extent of the damage by the week of unrest became evident, we needed to move with speed, and we spent that following week actively working on a financial package that drew on discussions within government and between DTIC agencies, trying to see where we could snip and restructure and reprioritize our own resources and putting together the business case to Treasury for additional resources. So that was really just getting the money earmarked. The second phase was to take account of the problems with business as usual, with a normal approach. And so the DTIC institutions developed a pipeline that went beyond the traditional IDC NEF clients. They used conventional application processes, yes, what we've always done, but they also did new things, for example, following up on the DTIC survey results, as well as site visits and virtual meetings. The next slide shows phase three of the work, which is based on the pipeline and resources. The first tranche of approvals was made with this adjusted approval process, and we introduced the first part of what we call working differently. I refer to the outcomes of the survey. We made the survey details available to the IDC and NEF and said, you can draw on this to identify potential applicants. The state shouldn't just wait. It can even approach companies and say, look, we know that you've been damaged. Can we be of some assistance? Some of the agencies introduced quicker processes for approval, and they did it broadly within the current risk assessment framework that their governance structures had approved. So that was the third phase. The fourth phase is the one we're in now from the work that we've recently completed. We reviewed the system of support. We had meetings with the leadership of the IDC and the NEF, meeting on once or twice a week in the last few weeks. And following that review and the impact of the support, we tweaked and changed the arrangements in a number of areas. It's really strengthening what we call the working differently, the agile state, the state that can move faster. So first, the IDC looked at expanding the types of support available with a better blend between loan and grant funding. Previously, it had a very modest portion of grant funding, and it was principally loans. Now it's reset that balance somewhat, and it's taking that now through its processes. The agencies have simplified the application system further. They've removed red tape. They've reduced the extent of paperwork required. Typically, you may want to have a five-year business plan projection under ordinary circumstances. Under these circumstances, we need and have introduced now new less onerous requirements. And some of it has been through the site visits and the feedback we've got from businesses. The IDC has also introduced a new customized credit and investment guidelines. The qualification criteria have been expanded, including in respect of firms that had insurance cover, where the insurance cover was pledged to the banks. And we've also looked at, in the case of one of the agencies, to an increase in the applicable limits for each firm. There's expedited approval processes, with committees now meeting on a daily basis as required. Previously, there were set dates for committee meetings, and the applications were then bunched into those set dates. Now the agencies are available on a daily basis. The minute there are applications that qualify, their committees are activated immediately, and they're able to consider that. The next slide makes the point that what the unrest highlighted is the urgency of building a more inclusive economy. And we make that point because it reduced the opportunity for those who seek to undermine the democratic order to find fertile conditions in communities. And this is quite an important one because those who seek to cause destruction rely on the fact that there are a number of young people without jobs, and there is, in many communities, a sense of frustration at the limited opportunities available. It raises the need for new approaches. How do we ensure that spaza shops and retailing in township, that those opportunities are available to members of a local community, that there's access to shopping malls? While the big retailers are seeking to expand their businesses, and from within the logic of the large retail, it makes complete sense. For communities, what that means is fewer opportunities for local shops, for local players to enter the market. And so there's a deeper assessment that would be required there. Access to shopping malls also, these shopping malls have been growing all over, including in semi-urban areas, and local communities very seldom have access to those malls for the distribution of their products. The key focus now is to scale up and speed up so that the economic benefits flow to communities and to GDP growth. Within the broader development of districts, what we call the district development model, in the work that we need to do, we recognize that post-investment and mentorship support is critical to help businesses to recover. It varies, of course. Smaller businesses need this much more. Rebuilding must be based on helping to grow opportunities for local communities, and that is greater partnerships. When I visited Isithebe and listened to the business community there, and then listened to the mayor of the local municipality, it became evident that there was a standoff between parts of the community and businesses. And we asked the mayor to launch an Izimbizo to address the frustrations and the concerns that both groupings had. Local development conditions have been added to loans and grants to activate more opportunity in communities, and the focus is very strongly on small and micro businesses. Informal businesses that are linked to the ecosystems of shopping malls, for example, have been wiped out. They've been significantly affected. This is the core mandate of the Department of Small Business Development, but the DTIC wants to collaborate and look at ways in which it can support and assist the Department of Small Business Development, because we're in this together to try to make sure that the entire pipeline from micro to large businesses are able to recover. We are looking now to updating the survey results to identify the number of businesses that are back at full operation. I've asked the team to just do further work on it. And finally, law and order is critical for investment and for consumer confidence. Businesses are not going to invest with confidence if they feel that there is going to be a recurrence on a regular basis of the activities that we've seen. So while the economic intervention is important, it has to be complemented and rest on a strong law and order platform in which the rule of law is critical, that people are able to plan their business decisions with a certainty, that contracts can be enforced, that the physical property and the safety of employees and customers are paramount. So these are key observations from the work. In the next three sections, the Acting Director General Malebo Mabitsi Thompson will take the committee through some of the specific micro observations and work of the department, and she will then be followed by the CEO of the IBC, who will deal with part three, and he will no doubt call on members of his team, and then part four will be done by the CEO and chair of the NEF. So with your support and your permission, Chairperson, can I hand over to the acting DG to walk us through part two?
Thanks, DG.
Thank you, Minister, and thank you, Chair, and good morning to the honourable members, good morning to my colleagues, and good morning to everyone who is locked on to this discussion. Chair, as Minister has indicated, we are now in the recovery management process, and what that requires is coordination within the three spheres of government and the related agencies, and national level, even among the different department, departments at national level. Minister has indicated the Department of Small Business, but there are various other departments as well, in the agriculture space, all the sectoral departments, because this disruption really affected many sectors across the economy. And what it calls for also is strengthened partnerships between ourselves and the business community. Minister has indicated that the process we're involved in now, improving our communication and making sure that the business community is fully aware of the support that is in place to make sure that businesses resume business as quickly as possible, that workers are re-employed as quickly as possible, that we normalize activity as quickly as possible. So we've been involved in a number of communication platforms to send out that message to our partners in industry, and we've done so in collaboration with particularly KwaZulu-Natal, the provincial government of KwaZulu-Natal, and also in Gauteng as well, where we've had a number of engagement with the Gauteng government and the leadership in Gauteng and both and also in KZN to just break down the coordinated approach, and as I indicated, to make sure that businesses are provided the support that they require to get back into business as soon as it is possible. In this slide, we are sharing with the portfolio committee some of the webinars that we've been a part of. As you can see there, with the different logos, it involves a number of agencies in government, some at national level, and in the provinces as well, in order to just spread the message that there is support that is available, and enterprises should reach out in order to receive that support. We put together an email address in which inquiries can be sent, and with that portal we've been able to get around 185 inquiries that have been immediately responded to where it needed to be sent to the different agencies. That has been done, and what we are seeing from that is that there's a need for both financial and non-financial support. We've also been involved in webinars over which were attended by over 1,500 people, again making sure that the message goes as far as it is possible, so that the business community, workers, the communities also know the support that is available to assist with the recovery. And we are also making clear what the rules are for companies to get the support that they require. Through our Invest SA, which is really a branch in the department that is responsible for unblocking any challenges that may be there for enterprises to grow and to thrive, be they challenges at local government level or even at national level, be they regulatory or non-regulatory. We really saw InvestSA coming into perform through this this crisis, doing what it was created to do. Consulted around 60 companies. This includes big companies that we are mentioning here, but much smaller companies that are in the different localities, companies like LG, Sumitomo, Malabar, DeFi, Cipla, Samsung, Tiger Brands, just to mention a few of those that we've been working with through this crisis. The issues, as I indicated, are both financial and non-financial issues relating to clearance at the port, where we had facilitated the release of cargo at port for BMW, for J&J, and a number of companies that are important for supplying critical medical supplies. In partnership with the KZN government, we've facilitated the GBS sector to be operational during the unrest period so that they can continue to serve international clients. We've worked with the Cipla Metro in the South Coast, Mobeni, Durban, which produces antiretroviral and therapeutic drugs. These ones were severely affected by the unrest. They were invaded, and there was damage. And as you know, with this type of activities, there's always a sensitivity around who enters what part of the production process, and how those people should be prepared in entering those production processes. So if any of those safety health protocols are breached, then they do result in immediate damage, both to not only property but to stock that may have been in the process of being produced. So we've worked with those companies, United Pharmaceutical Distributors in Pinetown, who were also looted, B-Brain, who's now moved into new premises, Sumitomo warehouse in Westville, Durban, that was also destroyed and looted. As Minister had indicated, key among what drives our engagement is to try to work with the companies to get back into production as soon as possible. Hence, you will see that we will highlight that, for example, Cipla, they free opened, and a number of these companies that we are working with now, they are now in the process of stabilizing operations, and we do expect that they will come back into production as quickly as it is possible. Next slide. Working with our own DFIs within the DTI stable, Minister had indicated that the Cabinet and the President had announced the package. That package included some of the funds that the DTIC had reprioritized to support the recovery process. It also included fresh injections of funding from National Treasury. Our work there continues with the UIF, with SASRIA, and also with CIFA. We are extending our reach to a number of other agencies in order to make sure that there is a collaborative effort towards the relief, and that enterprises, as far as possible, find a seamless process in government in their quest to receive support and get back to business as quickly as it is possible. And we've been driving this work primarily through our industrial financing branch in the BTIC, bringing together our normal stakeholders in the form of the NEF and IDC, but also the new ones, SASREA, which we hardly ever deal with. And as Minister has indicated, our engagement with them has been most productive. And we've been able to receive the support that we require to be able to put together a package that is meaningful for enterprises. Next slide. In the DETIC itself, we will be managing the critical infrastructure reconstruction program. Here we are looking at helping companies to rebuild where there's been damage to property in the form of buildings. And our focus at the moment, also as Minister had indicated, is with the industrial parks. We know that Isikebe and Magadeni were severely hit by the unrest, and we are working with Itala to ensure that the industrial park is back in operation, and that the relevant factories are either reconstructed or where they are relocated within the industrial park, where alternative buildings are secured, that those buildings are made ready for the enterprises to go back to business as quickly as it is possible. And we are working here, as I indicated, it's with Itala, but also in partnership with SASREA and DBSA to get the infrastructure up and running in the shortest possible time. Next slide. To be eligible for this support, of course, the entities must be registered in South Africa. That is the usual requirement. We're looking at entities in and outside the industrial parks in those areas that were affected by the recent unrest. And we are also looking to ensure that all the governance processes Minister mentioned are also put in place, that we take out any potential for any double dipping, that the support is provided to businesses in a way that doesn't enrich people from this crisis, but rather assist enterprises to get back to business as quickly as it is possible. Thank you. The next slide. So I think, Minister, our input will conclude there. What would then follow would be the work of our partners and our DFIs in the DTI family, DTIC family, the IDC, and the NEF in our joint quest to ensure that we manage this recovery as best as we can possibly do, making sure that enterprises receive support in a timely manner and they receive the quantum of support that they require. Thank you, Minister. Back to you, through you, Chair.
Thank you very much, DG. And then, Jefferson, if we may be able to call on the leadership of the IDC, perhaps the CEO would want to introduce the portion of the report, with your permission, Chair.
Okay, you can proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, members of the committee, and thank you, Minister. Thank you for the opportunity to make an input on behalf of the Industrial Development Corporation regarding these this extraordinarily important work that we are engaged in. The first slide, which is on the screen, really in summary is to say that as the events unfolded, these unfortunate events of unrest, the first order of business for us indeed was to do an impact assessment. We initially started by looking primarily at our client business partners to see the extent to which our portfolio companies that we have funded, that we have assisted, could have been impacted by this particular unfortunate set of events. We will show in the next couple of slides the findings regarding the impact assessment. We did this by sending our officials out into the fields, but also conducting surveys and sending out surveys and getting quite substantial responses from our client community. And these responses gave us insights as to the level of impacts and gave us insights as to the possibilities that we could then follow in the design of our response package. So in the second instance, it is important to mention that we then worked with our sister organizations in the DTIC family in order to design or to inform the design of the support package. So moving on to the next slide, it's a lot of statistics. But basically, Chairperson, we surveyed somewhere in the order of about 283 clients, and we could establish that a significant portion of them were one way or the other, either directly or indirectly affected. And I think directly we mean in a sense that business operations have been interrupted directly on site. Maybe a factory has been burned or equipment stolen or stock removed. Indirectly, maybe in the form of interruptions to supplies or employees can't get to site to go and work and things like that. But we also started talking to them regarding whether what would their be their response to financing offering and so on, and what their preferences would be in that regard. And we could tell that people were saying, yes, we would welcome funding. Some of them said, no, we would welcome a situation where you, as the IDC, give us breathing space by deferring our payment obligations to later dates, and so on. The impacts were across all sectors, yes, largely in our assessment in the chemicals and clothing and textiles environment, but really across the various industries of the IDC. The graphs on the right-hand side really indicate the rand value of the impact. So when you take the impacted clients in the IDC and we say what is the extent of our exposure to them, either how much money do they owe us in loans or how much do we have invested in equity or other forms of instruments in those companies. So it is an interesting picture in a sense that Gauteng has this tendency of attracting more in terms of quantums of capital. So KZN physically more impacted, but a little less so from an IDC perspective in terms of the size of exposure, just to interpret correctly, Chairperson, the graphs, just to give us insight. Moving on to the next slide, we just want to make a couple of points here with regards to jobs, Chairperson, members of committee, and say, in certain instances, in many instances, jobs adversely affect us in the sense that businesses have been closed, so the jobs have effectively been lost because the business doesn't exist anymore. In the second instance, there are temporary layoff arrangements, so the business is still there, perhaps it was impacted to a lesser extent, but workers have had to be sent home, because operations haven't resumed yet. In the third instance, Chairperson, we have seen instances where the businesses indeed have been stopped in terms of operations, interrupted, and so there is uncertainty. That's what we can call uncertainty, in a sense that workers do not know if they are coming or going. They just know that their factory is still there, maybe partially damaged, stock has been lost, so they are in between, not knowing whether they are coming or going. And this is probably the painful part, as Minister indicated, the social impact of or the social consequences of this unfortunate incident. So I won't go into the detailed statistics, but really those are the headline messages as I have summarized. So if I may move on to the next slide, again, here a little bit of detailed see-through, because as the Industrial Development Corporation, we needed to evaluate the sectoral level impact of these unfortunate events. And what we see, as I have just mentioned, that really spread across all industries. However, certain industries may be certainly impacted more than the others in terms of impact. We see here more incidents in the chemical industries, a lot of incidents in the textile environment, and of course, small business areas. These are small and medium-sized enterprises that are funded primarily through our regional office channels throughout the country. Interestingly, tourism and service business is also affected, which have borne the brunt of COVID, as we know, and things have just been made worse by these incidents of the past. So these are these sector-level statistics, disruptions to raw material supplies, disruptions to the delivery of goods as companies try and take their product to market. Indeed, tourism companies, less and less people or even no people at all pitching up for service or for consumption of the services that are offered by these establishments. So this is to give us a deeper appreciation of the depth and diversity of impacts as they have manifested in the various industry categories, particularly that the IDC serves. Moving on to the next slide, and this is the crux. Minister has covered this. I will just lift a couple of messages to say the 1.4 billion rand that the IDC has allocated from its own balance sheet at this point in time is primarily in the form of a loan program. It's a lending product, yes, with a certain concessionary elements, and I'm referring here to the fact that we provide a moratorium on the repayment up to a period of 1 year. The pricing at the moment is also concessionary in a sense of somewhere in the order of prime, and it is this attribute as well that we are revising, and I will come back to you members of committee regarding what we are proposing, still subject to consideration by our board of directors, which is sitting tomorrow, and so we hope to clear some of these enhancements. The 100 million is a grant allocation, really, which we thought we would give to businesses that are highly vulnerable in township areas. The majority of them are retail type, service type businesses, that requires relatively small amounts of money, and we do this through our enterprise development unit at the IDC, and so they are non-recoverable grants. funds, we allocated 100 million rand to that. We also put aside some CSI money, 10 million rand, which we thought, Chairperson, members of committee and minister, we would rather primarily target at the reconstruction of the infrastructure at schools, you know, support care facilities and clinics and things like that, instead of the generic CSI, which is, we didn't want to do standard things like, you know, food parcels to communities and things like that, but rather try and niche to supporting the recovery of those very important social institutions in communities such as clinics and so on, to bring them back to their feet. But yes, partnering with other with our CSI partners, there is also allocations that are going to relief in terms of food provision, part of that 10 million rand. Then of course, as my colleague, the DG acting has indicated, we have an allocation of 400 million rand from the DTIC under the MSEP scheme, which we blend and into the financing packages that the IDC offers. Moving on to the next slide, in terms of the sort of operational arrangements, the delivery system that the IDC has put in place in order to enable this intervention, we are just indicating there that firstly, there has to be communications channels through which the IDC officials or the IDC service points can be accessed. So to this extent, the call center, the email addresses, and the various other platforms that are web-based platforms that potential beneficiaries can access the IDC through. And judging by the volumes of applications that we've received, as much as they are not that heavy as we would like them to be, but certainly these contact systems, these access points, are working appropriately. We can always improve. The second point to make, Chairperson, is that we have set aside a dedicated team. These are individuals that we have literally pulled out of their regular work, out of their regular departments of units, and we said, for the next number of weeks, you are doing nothing else but focusing on this program. Your job on a daily basis is to receive, to originate, and to process, and to evaluate, and to take to the decision committees the funding applications that are related to this program. So so the human capital deployment is in that way. And indeed, they are dedicated coordinators, people who literally are sitting in front of their computers on a daily basis in order to coordinate and to monitor the activity on the portals, you know, the information that is coming through, the inquiries, pulling those through, and then sending those to the transaction team. So these four coordinators, in addition to a dedicated team of 15 investment professionals that I referred to a minute ago. In addition to that, we are running communication and publicity in order to disseminate information across the breadth and length of particularly KZN and Gauteng. We can improve on this. We want to do better on this. And the discussions that we have been having as a DTIC family is also that we should do more of walking the streets, sending boots on the ground, walking door to door, so to speak, at these sites that have been affected as part of the entire program or effort of disseminating and reaching out. The next slide, Chairperson, is, as Minister indicated, just the statistics relating to the level of progress that we have made up to this far. Indeed, we have those nine transactions which are in assessment, in due diligence, among amounting in total to about 349. If we manage to get those over the line and we see no reason why we should, we shouldn't during the course of this week, we hopefully shall have approved close to 500 million, half a billion we want to reach in the next day or two on these transactions that are in assessment. And then there are those inquiries that we must also process. We are processing even as we speak. So indeed, if we execute competently, and there's no reason why we shouldn't, and we should hold ourselves to high standards, indeed, in the short term, in the next week or so, we should be reaching the billion rand mark and above in terms of performance under this program. The minister has alluded to the various interventions that we are implementing. Some of them require approval of the board, and as I indicated, we are approaching the board tomorrow. For instance, the enhancement of the grant portion in this package. Secondly, the downward adjustment of our pricing, the loan rates, interest rates on the loans. We are approaching the board to seek a downward adjustment in order to increase affordability. Thirdly, relaxation of certain credit criteria that we normally apply on a standard basis. The fourth intervention that we are looking at is reconsidering the quantum, the maximum amount, and at the moment that maximum amount that we can grant is 30 million rand. We will have a discussion with our board tomorrow to see how far we can lift it up in order to increase the impact. And then, of course, Minister has indicated that in terms of our decision cycle, we are sitting as the actual committee already on a daily basis starting this week. And of course, the last intervention that we are considering is a business support intervention to support these businesses with technical assistance, advisory, operational management, so that they really get back on their feet and become sustainable in the long term. You know, Chairperson, members of committee, I can just, if you allow me to veer off from the presentation a little bit and just share that, you know, I put a call over the weekend and chatted to some of my colleagues who work at the African Development Bank, and I was wanting to chat to them, and I did, about what they have, what they call a post-war reconstruction program. So some of the countries on the continent that have been through difficult war times, I know it's not the same with this, what kind of measures. And there's a common thread that runs through post-unrest or post-war support programs. One is the requirement for safety and security. And yes, our government thankfully has addressed that element. Secondly, is the need for capable institutions that can deliver support. And so to this extent, as a country, we are fortunate. We have the DTIC, we have government, we have the Industrial Development Corporation, we have the NEF, we have the Development Bank, the whole host of capable institutions that can deliver support programs. The third one, and this is an important one, is that funding very often is in the form of grant-based programs that come from donor communities, or if the loans are made, they are made in a very concessionary way, very affordable, easy to access, long-dated in order to give breathing space. And these are the kind of revisions that we are making to the IDC package to make it deeply concessionary, substantively donor-focused in order to give a chance for recovery. And then the fourth and the last element that runs through these programs is business support measures, institutional measures to help differences, not only with money, but with management capability, opening up markets, support for accessing suppliers, and so on and so on. And these, it was a very interesting conversation I had, and I went to a little bit into the literature on this particular aspect, and it was insightful and confirmed that indeed we are on the right path as a team, Team South Africa. And then moving on, Chairperson, and I will now conclude very quickly. This select client, Global Source, we granted them 30 million rand. They are in the clothing and textile environment. Then the number of jobs saved there, as we can see, in the order of 369 people whose livelihoods will be restored. The next one is Kingsgate, also in the clothing and textile environment. Next slide. Kingsgate, about 180 people who work there. We have granted them 10.5 million rand. It is a bridging finance facility, as we indicate at the bottom of the slide there, in a sense that they will redeem it from their insurance proceeds. So 10 million rand to this company as a form of bridging finance. The next one, is this particular company employs quite a sizable number of people, 1,200, and what we have advanced there is an amount of 60 million rand, 60. It is a combination of IDC's own money and also drawn from MSEP in this regard. The next one was a small grant that we gave to this company, a grant of 1 million rand. It's a term loan of 1 million rand for working capital in order for them to restore their raw material purchases. They are in the wood industry, as we see in that interesting picture at the top there. That's what they manufacture. Employ 30 young people there, as we see them there. The next one also, this one is in the form of a grant of 700,000 to this independent pharmacy in the Foslo area, the East Rand. So we are assisting them to get back on their feet with stock as well as equipment. And like a typical pharmacy, a small number of people who work there, about six or so, owned by a black woman. We hope she will be back on her feet soon. The next one, also a company employing a group of women in the textile environment. Again, this one is a grant. It is 1.8 million rand. 1,800,000, and also in a similar vein, a grant to restock and to get their machinery back in order to continue their production. The next client is the National Stockfell Association. They are a retail financial intermediary, so we have given them a grant of 5 million, and what they will do is that they will pass it on to their member, their members, probably in smaller chunks, classically maybe in the township will be 100,000 to that client, another 150,000, and so on and so on. But these are very high impact organizations when they do their work well, members of committee. And so that is that. The next one is this one here, Ikwezi. I can't recall the number that we granted them. Is also, so let me just check. So we're just giving you, members of committee, a flavor of the cases that we have assisted so far and how much we are giving it to each one of them. Ikwezi, is 29 million rand. 29 million rand is equally also in the form of part bridging loan and part a term loan. Zero interest rate at this point in time. It's in Eshawe in Natal. 29 jobs being saved there. The next one. So these are just our contact details, Chairperson, and members of committee, and that brings us to the end from the IDC side. Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to provide this overview to the committee. Much appreciated. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you, Kibi, and Chairperson. I know that the committee would be keen to engage, so we are getting to the last part of the presentation. I am going to ask the CEO of the NEF to briefly run us through the presentation. The Chair has alerted me to the time challenges of the committee. So with your permission, if I can ask Pilisiwe Tetwa to briefly run us through the last part.
Good morning, Minister. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee. It gives us great pleasure as the National Empowerment Fund to be part of this delegation that is led this morning. So I will try and run through the slides. So as Honourable Members are aware, when the NEF witnessed a spate of civil unrest in the month of July that resulted in the destruction of property and closure of many businesses in Gauteng and KZN, the NEF immediately undertook an assessment of the impact of the unrest on its existing portfolio within the affected areas. So, Honourable Members, the unrest affected, you will see it on this slide, a total of 39 funded businesses, NEF funded businesses, accounting for 413 million rand. 13 of these transactions were severely affected, and these have a combined value of 137 million. And 1,500 jobs have been placed in imminent peril. Thankfully, only 26 businesses valued at 271 million were interrupted for an average of 5 days and are back in business. Together, these account for 1,195 jobs. To date, the NEF, the businesses that have lost, some of their assets, actually, they have a combined revenue of more than 50 million rand. The next slide is just showing the impact on the NEF portfolio by geography, ownership, and jobs. Of the 39 affected NEF businesses, 23% were owned by black women and 59% are located in KZN. On the next slide, this shows the NEF progress to date. The NEF has worked with its existing clients and has ensured that 80% of the affected clients return to full operation within a very short space of time. The NEF has been in contact with over 250 affected businesses from working together with the IDC and the DTIC. And Honourable Members, as a responsive organisation, which is an agency of the DTIC, various NEF teams are on the ground across both Gauteng and KZN in areas that were mentioned by the Minister earlier, but you can also see the areas on the screen. Just over a week ago, we hosted a webinar with black women entrepreneurs where we had more than 505 women-owned enterprises that attended that webinar. On Tuesday last week, we also presented at another webinar arranged by the Trade and Investment KZN on the theme that was referred to as the Rebuilding Resilient and Sustainable Economy in KZN. There we had more than 600 companies. And then this past Thursday, last week, together with the DTIC the NEF organized and hosted another webinar wherein developers, small managers, property developers, and a range of entrepreneurs engaged the DTIC and NEF investment professionals on solutions provided in relation to funding affected businesses. The webinar was themed Unpacking Government's Economic Rebuilding Package, and this webinar was attended by more than 1,000 participants. So it actually shows the level of interest in the support measures that were announced by the minister just a few weeks ago. Honorable members, we'll continue to make the public aware, in particular affected businesses, of the help that they are eligible for. So you'll see on my other slide, when I continue with my presentation, that we have even provided cell numbers of our colleagues who are currently on the ground as we speak. On the next slide, it just shows our intensified focus. Honorable members, what we seek to show here is that our teams of investment professionals comprising finance and risk assessment specialists, legal advisors and others have been deployed directly to the travel spots, as you can see on this map, to interact with and assist entrepreneurs whose businesses have been harmed and whose operations have ceased as a result. So they've gone to far-flung areas like the Zululand area, Umkhanyakude, Amajuba, and all of those areas. In fact, we were not aware as the NEF that most of these areas had been severely impacted by the riots until we were actually informed by the minister and the deputy ministers, because they had also visited most of these areas. But we also got a report from the parliamentary committee that was actually showing us some of the areas that were also visited by the parliamentary committee. So you can see that these are the names of people who are on the ground, and if the honorable parliamentarians, if they require their cell numbers, would be more than happy to share their cell numbers with you. So the deployment is for an initial two-week period, but we'll then assess and monitor the situation and see whether it's still going to be necessary for them, because they have gathered most of the information that that we're looking for. All in all, we have 30 professionals who are on the ground. So if the deputy minister and the ministers happen to be in these areas, what we do is to deploy the colleagues to those particular areas. So if the deputy minister or minister will be talking about the DTIC package, then they will come in to talk about what the NEF is going to be able to offer to the affected enterprises. The next slide, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, we are pleased to report that to date, the NEF has approved 18 transactions with a combined value of 112 million rand, supporting 1,683 jobs in both affected provinces. A further 39 transactions are at an advanced stage of assessment, specifically a due diligence stage, with a value of 63 million. So this will be approved this week, and it takes our total approval to 175 million rand. A further 318 million is already at a DD phase. We have also generated tangible leads to the value of 900 million rand, and these are mainly from the retail and industrial property owners. We believe we have an ideal mechanism to provide assistance for these entities, because it is important, honorable members, to make sure that we rebuild the infrastructure in order to ensure that our small and medium businesses can find accommodation or a return for trading. So we've been engaging with the property owners, and fortunately for the NEF, we already had a big portfolio of investments in this particular sector, where they already invested more than 1 billion rand, but the total value of our investments, because the 1 billion would have leveraged an additional 2 billion from the private sector, is estimated at more than 3 billion rand. So we have a good track record in working with the various property developers, so it was very easy for us to actually navigate the space. But when we were engaging with the minister and the deputy minister, they have emphasized the need for us to ensure that as we will be rebuilding and involved in the reconstruction work, that we need to ensure that we also achieve our other developmental objectives like transformation. So if you look at the work that we'll be doing around the reconstruction of the malls, we are adding them to actually make sure that when they will be hiring employees who will be working on their construction sites and in other areas, let's make sure that we employ people from these rural communities or township economies. But also when it's about the sourcing of products, we're saying let's make sure that they also prioritize products that will be coming from black-owned enterprises. We're not saying everything must be given to black companies, but we're saying a portion of their total procurement spend must be spent on black-owned and women-owned enterprises. So a key tenet, honorable members, of NEF funding, as you will know, is employment creation, and we are pleased that the pipeline I've just outlined has a potential impact of 13,545 jobs. On the next slide, honorable members, malls and industrial parks are a priority focus, as I have already mentioned, of the rebuild trajectory, because the infrastructure supports SMEs to gain entry to markets. We have visited property owners across Gauteng and KZN, as I have already mentioned, and once rebuilt, these critical infrastructure requirements could unlock a further 395 million rand just in normal funding. I'm no longer referring to the economic recovery package. So it has now allowed us to engage with the various owners of these businesses to look at the opportunities for expansion, the opportunities for them to diversify into other areas and so on. So the 395 million is just the initial estimate of the funding that will actually come about as a result of the engagements that we're having with them on the ground. So from our direct interaction with the affected entrepreneurs, a total 118 businesses spread across 14 district municipalities in both provinces, there we have indicated interest in the NEF, there they have indicated interest in the NEF Economic Relief Fund, which was another fund that we're managing on behalf of the DTIC. So, honorable members, our presence on the ground, the physical presence on the ground, is yielding the desired impact after just 2 weeks in the field, and the interest is gaining momentum on a daily basis. Slide 60, this is just criteria to access our funding. I'm sure the honorable members will be getting a lot of, I think it's the next slide on the criteria to access funding. So here, honorable members, we're just saying that if you happen to get queries, you can actually refer the entrepreneurs to us at head office, or we'll be sharing the banner that has all these various requirements, these things that the honorable members are familiar with, that the business must be located in Gauteng and KZN. The applicant must also show that the business is not covered by insurance or there's an insurance shortfall component. The beneficiary must be a registered company. Of importance, the applicant must demonstrate that jobs lost during the unrest will be restored or increased within 12 months of funding. Where a business is insured, funding can be provided as bridging finance or providing a maximum of 10 million, which can be topped up with other funds that we are raising from our other partners. The funding will not accrue any interest, and the maximum tenure for a loan will be 60 months. Loan facility funding will be priced at 0%. So we also offer a blend of financing instruments. We look at the the actual requirements, financial requirements by the company, and then we will then decide on the mix between the grant portion, the loan financing, and any other financing instrument that we will think is appropriate to support that particular company. So 61, I think, is just talking about the other continuous NEF interventions. That section has been appropriately, it was appropriately covered by the minister and the DG. Slide 62, I think this one also was covered by the minister and the DG. And on the last slide, one of the most exciting initiatives that we are working on, honorable members, and obviously it gives us pleasure to actually report that the NEF team assisted in the recruitment of 65 unemployed graduates who possess various qualifications. These are young engineers, ECOM graduates, it's young lawyers who are sitting at home as a result of the macroeconomic conditions that we find ourselves in as a country. So the graduates will be provided training on the various aspects. In fact, they are already here at head office as we speak. They come from all the 9 provinces of the country. So we'll be training them on the various aspects of NEF operations so that we may maximize our ability to support the NEF target market. 63% of the recruits are women and 37% are males. We're doing this in partnership with the DTIC, is the Department of Transport, because there are other programs that we were already involved in. So for the project that we're working on currently, we just tapped into some of those graduates that we already have. The recruits commenced the NEF trainee program on the 2nd of August, and 32 trainees are based at the NEF head office, and others are in KZN and Eastern Cape. In fact, they are everywhere. Regional trainees will adopt the same shift roster as applied at head office. And then the next slide, which is slide 64, we're just showing our various enterprises, investee companies and enterprises that have been supported by the NEF through this initiative. The first one is in the food processing sector. It's 100% black women owned and managed. It employs more than 60 people. It's called Wine Foods. The property was vandalized and looted, and we have approved 18 million for this particular company. The next one is Ikwebuletu, which is a burial services company. It's 100% black woman owned. It employs more than 1,000 employees. You may have seen the coffins during the riots. We didn't understand, nobody understood why people would actually go and steal coffins, but it just shows that we were in serious trouble as a country. So we have provided 19 million, which is the first tranche, this a particular company. The next one is KPML Group, which is in the retail sector. The group is majority black woman owned and managed. It has more than 1,000 employees, and we have provided 10 million to this company. The next one is Sikhanyisele Trading. It's in the fuel retail sector. It's also 100% black women owned. It has 42 employees, and we have given it, we have approved 6 million rand for this particular company. The next one is SA Paint Distributors, 100% black owned. It's a paint distribution entity. 6 million has been approved for this particular company. The next one on slide 67 is Akwenezi Enterprises, wholly black women owned. It has 15 employees. The next one is Spartport Group, 100% black owned. We have provided 5 million rand as a working capital facility to save 42 jobs. The next one is Ligugulethu, 100% black woman owned. We have provided 4 million rand to this entity. It has 42 permanent employees. The next one is Divine Inspiration. It's based in Wamashu in KZN, 100% black woman owned. It has more than 62 employees, and we have provided 3 million rand to this company. And the last one is Logoman, which is wholly black owned. It has been operating for more than 13 years at Umlazi Mega City Shopping Center. So this is the shopping center, one of the shopping centers I was referring to earlier. As you get into Umlazi Township, is one of the largest in KZN townships. It was actually, the actual mall was actually supported by the NEF from inception, but we're able to leverage other funders into the transaction, and we have also supported this particular entity. I thank you very much, Honorable Member.
Thank you very much to the CEO, Chairperson. May I hand back to you, and thank you for the opportunity to present the work of the DTRC group.
Can we actually then go back to the members? Thank you, Minister, and to the other presenters. Can I actually then invite members to comment or ask questions to the presentation that we received? It's quite a detailed one, and it's quite a long presentation. I think one would actually invite members to comment or ask questions. Honourable Member.
Mr. Mulder, Mr. Cuthbert's chair at the moment.
Honourable Mulder.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Minister. I will thank you for a comprehensive report on a very important and unfortunate matter, Honourable Minister. I've got three issues that I wish to raise, which all speaks to one topic and one issue. The first being the setback to the economy, mentioned on page 21 of the presentation. The setback to the economy's post-COVID recovery and short-term performance is a severe one, and in a very considerable series. The question I want to ask is, Minister, do you know in the department recognize the real impact that the unrest, looting and destruction has on investors' confidence? Do you pick it up in the department where you go about and have contact with international investors? And then specifically the threat that this kind of behavior has on the existing and future international treaties. We visited a company with a name there, a German company, which was fortunately, they could still go on with their business, but they had to protect themselves. But it's a multi-billion rand investment, and should they have been destroyed, businesses like that would most certainly not have invested or reinvested in South Africa again. And then lastly, a very serious one. It's about a principle that I find and I hear right through all the committees and in this committee's reports and from the department. And it's the idiom in which the government and the department carries over the reality, the views and expressed, which I find a bit unfortunate. And let me explain. The way of thinking, if I could refer to the paragraph, and I'm going to, on page 29 of the presentation, the unrest highlighted the urgency of building a more inclusive economy to reduce the opportunity for those seeking to undermine the democratic order to find fertile conditions in communities. Now, Honourable Minister, my problem is, which I find very unfortunate, and I'm saying this with all respect and taking into consideration what poverty actually is. It expresses a view that it might be understood that people can loot because they are hungry, and they destroy because they are angry. And this is creating a culture of entitlement. This is a concern to me. The fact is, the more unemployment grows, the bigger the group of the absolutely poor. Even if the top groups didn't earn more, the group between them and the bottom groups has greatly increased. So one needs to know that unemployment was approximately at 3.5 million in 1994 and is well over 11.4 million today. So inequality has indeed and certainly increased. The trend of rising inequality got much worse between 2008 and 2017, during that period. I'm honestly of opinion that a total new way of thinking should be implemented or is required to establish a real inclusive economy to eradicate jobs, inequality and poverty. Thank you, Honourable Minister. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Carter.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation, Minister Patel. It's nice to see you on a Zoom meeting and not in selfies from the DTRC's official Twitter account, so that's a positive on our side. From my impression, Minister, you seem to be fairly independent in your own party, and I mean that's largely due to the fact that, you know, you aren't necessarily an MP and you are an external appointment, one of the two appointments that the minister, that the president is allowed to make. And I think that has implications in the way in which you're able to conduct yourself that other colleagues in your party may not necessarily be able to do. And I think that does give you a, you know, heightened sense of independence. So in lieu of that, my question then to you is, you know, what have you said to your colleagues, you know, in either faction with respect to the actions and, you know, the involvement of, you know, certain elements of the political party and the unrest that ensued in our country almost a month ago? I mean, everywhere we went on the oversight visits, you would have seen that there were political slogans that were written all over the walls of defaced buildings and destroyed buildings. And there's no doubt that, you know, there was a premeditated set of actions that took place. And this was not merely as a result of, you know, poverty and inequality, even though, you know, the latter opportunistic elements of looting would have, you know, resulted by virtue of that cause. So that's my first question. The second thing that I'd like to raise, Minister, is regarding, you know, potential restrictions that there may be on accessing the various development finance funds. Now, we saw during the COVID lockdown that we had a situation, particularly in respect of the Tourism Equity Fund, where certain BEE restrictions were applied, and most obviously, if you did not comply, you were not able to get access to that funding. Now, we've had white members of South Africa, we've had black members of South Africa, we've had Indian members of South Africa, we've had colored members of South Africa, citizens across the spectrum that have lost their livelihoods, have had, you know, their livelihoods impacted upon because of the unrest. Considering that fact, does that then imply that, you know, the approach from your department will be to try and ensure that all jobs and businesses are protected rather than, you know, ones for specific racial groups? And if not, why? And then I'm sure that you would have explained this, you know, in brief in the presentation, but maybe just a more detailed breakdown of which line items were adjusted on the budget to arrive at the 3.9 billion rand package. And then lastly, I think what was rather unfortunate on our part, and it was a late change to our program when we went for the oversight visit, was our inability to meet with Toyota. Now, you know, Toyota sent a very strongly worded letter to the city of Etiquini, and you know, they had subsequently leaked that letter, you know, which I've read in various business publications afterwards. It's kind of like, you know, a fatal move, because, you know, they are a conservative investing business, and obviously, you know, that has serious implications, and one would imagine that we would try everything to try and keep their operation and as well as, you know, future investment from that company in the country. So what has your engagement been with Toyota? And then secondly, another issue that was raised when we were on the oversight visit was by Cipla. Now, Cipla had a situation where a large proportion of the active ingredient that goes into ARV drugs was destroyed. And the impression that they gave was that people were taking the active ingredient, throwing it out on the floor, and then taking the bins and as well as the drums that it was contained in order to loot from the surrounding businesses. Now, they say that it's going to take a significant amount of time to obviously get the facility back to, you know, the relevant medical standards that they require, and they were asking that there would be some form of assistance to be able to allow, for them to be allowed to import this active ingredient. What measures have been taken in that regard, and what is it that you are doing to ensure that a company which supplies 25%, as they say, of the ARVs provided to the state are protected and are able to continue with operations? Because I think that, you know, that's a very serious supply chain issue if we have a quarter of our ARV stocks that are down because of the looting as a result of that.
Thank you, Honourable Carter. Are there any further comments, Secretary?
Chair, we have Mr. Mbuyani followed by Mr. Simmons, Chair.
Honourable Mbuyani. Honourable Mbuyani, maybe mute, unmute. I'm not sure if you collected still. I can see you on the list. Okay, let's actually then get Honourable Hammonds. We'll go back to Mbuyani. I'm not sure what's the problem. Honourable Hammonds.
Hi, Chair. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Can I thank the Minister and his team for a very comprehensive and hope-giving presentation, because we definitely need to rebuild what we have lost, and in rebuilding what we have lost, we have to build back better. It's a term I've heard from other DTIC officials, and I think if we make that a mantra and give it, implement it, we will all benefit from that. I just wanted to ask, Chair, maybe I missed it in the presentation, but I was just wondering, do we have a targeted plan to mitigate the withdrawal of foreign capital from South Africa? We saw in our oversight visit to SAMCO, which is a foreign-owned company, and then even Cipla, who produces HIV medication. You know that these are foreign-owned companies, and it is easy for them to take their money elsewhere. So what is our plan to ensure that we retain what we have? Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity.
Honourable Mbuyani, not sure if you connected.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Okay. I think I'm audible now.
Yes, thanks.
Chair, let me start by welcoming the presentation. Very much informative, and it gives us more understanding on the issues on the ground, what is happening with regards to the DTIC. Chairperson, I just have some few clarity-seeking questions around. One, maybe I just wanted to check the online survey that was launched by the DTIC. How far it has assisted? It was launched on 18 July. And how far is it assisted the rural flank of KZN, where people can be able to request assistance and funding? The other one, Chairperson, will be the application system is being simplified. further removing red tapes and reducing extent of paperwork and stuff. I just want to check in terms of the rural aspect, how does they be able to access this application system at the FAFLA on both issues. The other one, Chairperson, will be the issue in terms of the critical infrastructure development and investment. I just want to check, man, whether the NEF are able to assist in building infrastructure like hospital, the one that they did in Strand in Cape Town in 2017. Also checking the relevancy and the impact of the master plan visas the sugar industry. Because you'll find a situation where a lot of small-scale farmers and growers has lost everything. Sugar has been banned and they can't even claim any. And I don't know what are the interventions there on the issues of the sugar and the small farmers in the sugar industry. Maybe the last one has been already touched, the international investors, Chairperson. I'll just take the opportunity because our minister is here. Just to check the international investors and also the foreign-owned companies. What is it that they're doing in terms of upholding shareholdings, ownership, representation in terms of demographics? They just come to South Africa, they own companies, they invest, and so they. I just want clarity on this one, because I have heard the minister talking of inclusive economic growth, previous disadvantage in individual. How are they being assisted in those investments that the big, huge companies, foreign companies owned outside the country, Chairperson? I think I'll pause there for now. Thank you for the opportunity today.
Chair, we have Mr. Kring, Chair.
Honorable Kring.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine is a fairly simple question. Maybe one or two questions. The first is the amount of damage to property. It seems to be a bit of a moving target. Some estimates of 20 billion, others indicate anywhere up to 50 billion. And I know that the minister did indicate that there are still other groups that are trying to quantify what that particular damage is. Is there an update in terms of the damage caused to property? And I know in the presentation he said something like 20 billion. The other question also was with regards to, and I think some of my other colleagues have covered that, questions with regards to foreign direct investment and the fact that we actually do have the potential for our particularly the multinational companies with external investors threatening. Some have indicated already, I know in Etiquini, have indicated that they are not going to be coming back. And so what is being done? One of the companies, for example, in the Pinetown area, it is Amcor, it used to be in Nampak. The estimate cost there to the damage was some, just to get the factory back running again, was about 1.2, 1.5 billion rand, and that excludes the loss of, so that's the cost to company there, that excludes, loss of profits. So one particular company to rebuild 1.2 to 1.5 billion rand. So my guesstimate is that it may actually be far more than the 20 billion that the minister indicated. And then I think, like Honorable Mboyani, my concern, Chair, also is really for the small traders. And I think really if any economy wishes to grow, it is your SMMEs that actually grow your economies. Your multinationals and your big companies, they essentially look at downscaling in terms of cost cutting. But your smaller companies and your SMMEs are the ones who are looking at growing and hence wish take on more people and hence create employment. So our focus really, and I think many of our smaller companies lack the financial knowledge, and whether this is a hawker like in Isipingo, the ladies that are selling their peanuts and their mealy meals and wanting to grow that into something bigger, but don't have the financial know-how. And I think it's going to be absolutely crucial that we look at supporting local, because like Honorable Buyani also said, I'm not hitting at multinationals and foreign investment because we certainly need it. But what I am saying is, and I've been speaking about, you know, beneficiation, localization, and now we see how important it is. So, clearly, Chair, this needs to be ramped up, and I'm really concerned that we may be missing some of our smaller traders in this. The final question, Chair, just in terms of the pipeline of communication, what are the measuring instruments to ensure that this pipeline of communication that we have is going to be effective, where some of our companies that who lost everything, like the minister indicated, computers, paperwork, all gone, so it's difficult for them to provide proof that some of the entities may want. What is the turnaround time like for those particular companies, like in Isitebi, the factory that was burnt down? To get those jobs, some 600 jobs, and they only had about 80-odd people on site when we were there, because that's the only capacity that they had. So it's important and crucial that the turnaround time also be improved. Thank you, Chair.
Secretariat, I'm sure it covers the members who wanted to comment and ask questions.
Correct, Chair.
Yeah. Can I then actually go back to Minister Patel?
Well, first, thank you very much for the questions and also for the suggestions that have come from committee members. And I want to start perhaps with the question raised by Honourable Mulder. Honourable Mulder, I think you're absolutely right about the setback to the economy, very, very substantial. And one of the key things that we have been doing now with international investors is giving them the necessary reassurance that the security services are now in KZN and Gauteng. And also there's been deep lessons that has been learned and that the President has spoken about on how to ensure that within a constitutional democracy and absolute efforts to protect human life, that we also are able to address challenges to the law and the kind of looting and other actions we've had. That is, of course, the work of the security cluster, but we've highlighted the importance of that for the investment community. I've spoken to a number of different investors, foreign investors. For example, just to illustrate that I met with the global head of the Ford Motor Company, and they were very significantly concerned about what this means in the long term for the security of doing business. And we took them through, Ford has got 97 years history in South Africa, we took them through the detail of this, what this meant, why it was important for us to protect and support and hold the ground on the rule of law, that no person or grouping should be able, through violence or the threat of violence, to get decisions of the courts overturned and to avoid accountability. At the end of the discussion, not only did Ford indicate that they felt significantly more reassured, but the discussion then moved on how we can use their businesses here to expand the production of vehicles for the the opportunities that we saw on the African continent and beyond. The point I make out of that is law and order is critical. Investors operate in many, many different jurisdictions. They've seen good times, they've seen challenging times. What they principally want to know is that societies are able to learn the lessons from challenges like this, and that there is a stable environment in which they can operate. I think I want to highlight an important point that has come in on the investment matter from a number of different contributions, and that is the speed with which government can move now to address the law and order issues, to hold people to account, to have the prosecutorial authorities ensure that the affected persons, those who have led this and organized it and planned it, are held accountable and that the law takes its course. Investors look for that kind of sign, because if there are no consequences to what has happened, then these things can occur again and again. The second point that Honorable Mulder raises is about the narrative that Honorable Mulder, you indicate you're concerned about, namely that the implication may be that the violence and the looting is excused because people are hungry. I think Honorable Mulder, you and we would have the same view on one matter, that we can't excuse this looting and this burning on the basis of hunger. I visited plants where companies indicated to me a sophistication in the attacks on them. Their fire retardant systems were disabled. The sprinklers were deactivated. Blood banks were attacked. Clinics that does the dialysis for patients with kidney problems were attacked. So this was really an attempt to paralyze part of the commercial and industrial infrastructure of South Africa. And it was, in that sense, a law and order problem that needs to be addressed. But the point we make, and we hope you and your party can support us in this, is that what those with matches in their hand rely on is that when they fling those matches, recklessly or otherwise, that those matches can catch fire because of the dry tinder of unemployment and poverty. And when we deal with unemployment and poverty, and I think you are as committed as anyone else to deal with it, we remove the base on which they can rest and the large numbers of people that they can mobilize. That's really the point we make. And in moments like this, South Africans are getting together across different positions, and we've seen so many exceptionally heartwarming examples of South Africans standing together in defense of the Constitution and saying to us very clearly and echoing the words that we ourselves say, that we've got to deal with the underlying challenges that the society faces so that lawbreakers don't rely on drawing large numbers in. That's really the point we want to make, and I hope you can support that point. On the issue of inequality, I think it is highlighted. We didn't need this crisis to highlight the extent of the challenges of inequality, but it highlighted it. It drew it again into sharp relief. And there are things that we can and should be doing. And I hope that we can rely on your party's support when we roll out further measures to create greater economic inclusion. I know, Honorable Mulder, that you have been troubled at times by some of the measures to deal with transformation. And I have no doubt that in a number of cases, those measures could have been done better. But it is in everybody's interest, in the interest of the people who vote for your party as well as the people who vote for the majority party in this country, that we must address these high levels of inequality and unemployment and poverty. But to do that requires some difficult choices that we need to make. I drove through many townships in rural areas, as I know members of parliament do too. And we see so many retail opportunities are captured only by large players. And those large players often bring lower prices and greater access to a wide range of goods to communities. And they can do that because they have the buying power, they've got scale, and they're able to do that. But the consequence of it, Honorable Mulder, is that the opportunities that you find in many other societies across the world for people to get into small mom-and-pop shops, as they are called elsewhere, or spaza shops or township retailing, is removed. Now, that's quite a difficult policy challenge. And when we take measures to try to address that, we need wide support in society, and I will be looking, I hope, to you and your support also when those measures are done. They will always be done within a constitutionally sound framework, and the Constitution has to guide us. But dealing with deconcentration of ownership is critical. We have to deal with it. We must make that as a key part of our measures going forward, as we must with improving economic inclusion. I want to come later in dealing with Honorable Cuthbert's thing to make an important point that our measures that we've undertaken here, taken as a whole, is available to businesses. Many white South African businesses are being supported, as are businesses owned by black South Africans, in the measures that we've announced. Obviously, with the NEF given its legal mandate, it specifically focuses only on black-owned businesses. That's the legal mandate that the NEF has. The IBC and the DTIC has a broader mandate, which includes transformation, but it also includes supporting a number of other businesses that are owned by white South Africans. And we do that both because they are South African and because they contribute to the economy and because in many cases an economy is interlinked. You have the example was graphically illustrated when people in the informal sector are displaced because a big mall has been burned. There is this interconnectedness, and so we need to do that. So really, my hope is we can go beyond putting ourselves in corners in it. We need to have economic development across many different fronts. We need foreign capital. We need South African capital. We need township capital and township entrepreneurship. And we need opportunities for rural enterprises and for cooperatives. It's that suite of programs that together can give us what we need. Honorable Cuthbert, thank you for the questions that you've put. I was hoping, Honorable Cuthbert, that you could resist taking little swipes. It's not in your personality. I found you to be more rational and to raise difficult and challenging issues without the need to resort to snide remarks. But let's let that one go. You have raised one important issue that I want to respond to, and that is the premeditated action, that this was not some spontaneous uprising of poor people. And it's one that we agree with from what we have found in our visits and our work, and you will see that we've made that point in slide number 4, that the unrest was coordinated. And so I have, in response to Honorable Mulder, said that there is a law and order issue that needs to be addressed, and it has to be addressed very strongly and very clearly. You raise, though, the question of equity and whether our support is to everybody who will get jobs back and businesses back. And I've replied to that, and I've said yes. But like I've said with Honorable Mulder, I also hope, Honorable Cuthbert, that you will back and support our efforts at transformation at giving more opportunities, particularly transformation measures that are aimed at bringing black entrepreneurs into the mainstream economy and widening the pool of talent, letting those profits and dividends flow back into communities and building the capital base of Umlazi, Mandeni, and ensuring that people feel that there is economic opportunity in South Africa for those who historically have not had that opportunity. On the question that you raised around Toyota, first on the line items, let me first deal with the line items, and I should indicate there were three line items that the DTIC shifted funds from, reprioritized funds from. First one was in the manufacturing line item, particularly money earmarked for black industrialists. The second was the EMEA program, and the third one was the special economic zones. And we earmarked 400 million rand from the manufacturing line, 100 million rand from EMEA, and 200 million rand from the SEZ facilities. And that will then go now into the work, which is a combination of spatial interventions that the acting DG spoke of earlier, and the facility that the IDC and the NEF are currently managing. Turning to the issue of Toyota, Toyota was very concerned about the impact of the unrest potentially on security of their supply chain, their manufacturing facility, and their warehouses. And the DTIC worked closely with Toyota to ensure that there was a timely and adequate support for the protection of their property as quickly as we could mobilize those resources, and they were successful. And Toyota issued a statement in which they recognized and appreciated the reach out from national government, and subsequently, of course, they've met with the other spheres of government, and they indicated they're here to stay. But there are lessons there, and the lessons are that if we become associated in the mind of global investors with looting and damage to property, the appetite to invest in South Africa will decrease. And when that appetite decreases, it will have a deep impact on jobs and growth in the economy. And so we should not take these things lightly. We do need to see the seriousness of this in the period ahead. As regards the Stipler matter, one of the things that we're thankful for is that the company has sufficient stocks available. They've leveraged their global supply chain in the interim, so they're back, so they until they can get back on track. And the raw materials, the company reported to us that they have in hand, as well as those that are on the water to the company, is sufficient. And we have we've interacted with Stipler on this issue. More broadly, Honourable Cuthbert, we have ITAC has issued guidelines for a new rebate facility that is available in specific circumstances where companies genuinely cannot get the raw materials or the finished product even locally, and that has been gazetted and is available to companies. If I move then next, I think we've covered the questions raised by Honourable Cuthbert on Honourable Hermans's question. The Build Back Better slogan, Honourable Hermans, does represent what we are doing and should be doing. If we only get back to where we were before the unrest, then we've not done enough. So we need to be able to get those businesses rebuilt. But we also need to see opportunities. And I gave the IDC the example. One of the in one of my visits to one industrial area in KwaZulu-Natal, I came across a facility that had been badly damaged. And it was a facility that sold food and other products to workers in that industrial area. And it's a very basic and simple exercise. It's like a cash and carry, and there should be no reason why we can't support local entrepreneurs who come from the Mandeni community to set up those kind of cash and carry businesses, so that you build in a greater sense of co-ownership between local communities and businesses. One of the interesting experiences in different parts of the country was the role that taxi associations played. They knew that if the economy suffers deeply, then their businesses will be affected. And so they also mobilize their energies and efforts and members to protect malls and businesses. And that's the benefit of economic inclusion. When you see that you have a stake in the economy, then all of society take common action to protect those assets. And that's really, I'm hoping that with these examples, they illustrate the wisdom and value of supporting greater economic inclusion, to get ideas from a wide range of people of how we improve what we're doing, and that we stay the course. On the AMCO matter, Honorable Hermans, I met with AMCO and viewed the damage that was created, that was caused in the plant. They gave me initially, this was a few days, the embers were still burning by the time we did the visit there, and they gave us some estimates. Obviously, this is one of the big global companies owned by a group of Finnish investors, and I'm sure they have other shareholders too. And they do quite significant packaging, some of which is not easily available from other manufacturers. Our work with them has been on two fronts. The first is directly with the company, where we've engaged with them, and I think the last engagement may have been last Thursday or last Friday, where a number of options were identified. We gave them insight into the various facilities available, and they were looking at what they could do. The factory was completely burnt, so it's not a matter of just refurbishing. It really requires complete rebuilding exercise, and they're looking at some options. For example, should they shift to their Dube trade port? And the big issue is going to be that their global company will have to make the decision whether to rebuild. And that underlies why it's important that the messaging we get out to unions, to communities, and through our different structures is what has happened in KwaZulu-Natal and parts of Gauteng has deeply hurt our efforts on growth, our efforts on jobs, and our efforts on transformation. Not very far from the AMCO factory, I visited the factory in a electrical enterprise. And it was run by a team of black South Africans, a husband-wife team. And they had spent many, many years of their life building up that business. And in one day, that business was completely destroyed. And the CEO that I met with, a black woman, she just looked absolutely stunned at the damage as we surveyed what had happened there. So this has been a blow against our efforts at transformation, and we should not allow people to hide behind slogans that give the impression that this was done in support of efforts at transformation. On the contrary, it's a blow, it's a strong a setback for us in our efforts to build the economy and to build inclusiveness in the economy. I've also covered the Cipla matter, Honorable Hermans, that we've spoken to Cipla, and Cipla is rebuilding its facilities, and the initial media reports, as you would have seen from your own oversight visit, had indicated massive damage. Fortunately, the reality was less dramatic than that, unfortunately, in other parts of the economy, the damage was very, very significant, and we hope that working with Cipla that they can get back to full production as soon as possible. Honorable Mbuyane, on the online survey and the relationship to rural areas, we've tried to get the online survey completed not only through the traditional means, which is that we announce it publicly in a press conference and so on, but also by getting that message out when our team members have visited different rural communities. One of the things that's been interesting on the survey, because the survey is really our eyes and ears, from there it's what do we do with the results that's important. So the survey highlighted the significant number of companies that don't have insurance. And as we now put our packages together to try to deal with the uninsured rural enterprises that would be significantly affected can also benefit from that. But the survey was not our only means of finding out what happened. The NEF, for example, has mobilized a team of people. I think they divided them into probably something like six or so teams that went into different parts of KwaZulu-Natal, including small towns, and of course in our engagement with sugar farmers, we are talking very substantially with rural communities.
On no, sugar, we can round up now, Minister.
Just to briefly round up on sugar, we've put a slide together of what we're doing with the sugar industry. I hope we'll be able to strike a deal with them and come back and give the good news, Honorable Mbuyane. On the international investors and demographics, there are some things that we're doing now with international investors that's groundbreaking in promoting a wider vision of empowerment. For example, PepsiCo has now set aside 1.6 billion rand for shares by workers in the company itself. Coca-Cola set aside 15% of the equity in the company for workers, and there are examples like that. I can't ignore the questions by Honorable Tring. So very briefly, on the damage to property, we don't have a reliable further update as yet, Honorable Tring, because we are waiting now for the independent assessors that particularly is used by Sasria to give us a better sense of the extent of the damage. So we're using multiple sources, but as we hone in, we hope we'd be able to give you more reliable information. On the small and medium enterprises, I think you've put your finger on it. Very, very important, not only because of the overall job-creating impact, but also because in many cases, those small businesses don't have the means or the insurance cover to be able to get back on their feet. So a lot of our focus now is on that. I want to simply support your call that we do more things that will promote local businesses, local both in the sense of businesses operating in South Africa as well as opportunities in particular communities. And finally, we recognize that where records have been destroyed, and you quoted the example of a company called Kings Park in KwaZulu-Natal, that we need a more nimble approach, and we've raised this with the IBC and NEF, and we think that the next phase of their work will be much more tuned to trying to address those circumstances. At the same time, of course, because the Auditor General will ultimately hold us accountable for following the PFMA, and we need to strike that balance very carefully and ensure that we do it properly, and that there would not be significant findings, and that there's no gap or opportunity for corruption to come in the process, fraudulent claims to come in. But at the same time, it's not business as usual, and many small businesses have suffered greatly. Jefferson, and you and the committee have been extremely generous with time. I'm really sorry that we took as much time. I hope, though, that it does give the committee a sense of the urgency that the leadership of the department and the entities recognize needs to be injected packages together in a way that talks to all of the varied challenges from your micro businesses to your large businesses, from your domestic players to companies who are headquartered elsewhere in the world. We are trying within the limited resource envelope that we have to do all of that. We're working closely with National Treasury. We're working closely with the Department of Small Business Development, and we've been getting strong support from other parts of the state. So thank you very much, Chairperson. Sorry that not all of the replies were as comprehensive because of time, but I'm sure that this won't be the last time that the department and the entities will have an opportunity to bring reports and feedback to the committee. Thank you very much once again.
Thank you, Minister. Let me just say the coincidence is that we do have a discussion or debate at plenary on issues that we actually got through the presentation and the questions. And I think on my part, one would just suggest that there may be follow-up issues in terms of engaging at the portfolio committee, but the issue is out there, it's at plenary today. And I think the reports that we have received also adds a bit of value to the space for our discussions today. So the chair, the point which one would actually suggest strongly when we reconvene as a committee, if ever there's actually follow-up issues members do raise in the committee, we will actually then communicate, Minister, in terms of those kind of follow-up spaces that we may require to actually engage on as the portfolio committee with ministry, department and entities. Thank you very much, Minister. I'm sure we'll actually bring that to a conclusion. Because of the difference of the matter, I won't actually take follow-up questions as well, because we are in the middle of a discussion. Thank you, Minister, and thank you to the team. So let me just actually ask that we move to the next item. We would actually then ask from the South African Special Risk Insurance Association, SASRIA. We do actually have DG Dodo Mokajane, and we do actually have SASRIA CEO as well, Cedric Masondo. May I, Secretary, then invite the DG to be able to actually then speak to us, DG of the Treasury. Ndate Mohaja.
Thank you very much, Chair. I hope you are able to see me. I can't see myself.
Very clear, visible, and very clear in terms of your voice.
No,
loud and clear.
Yes. No, Chair, thanks. I've been sitting quietly, you know, as part of the meeting and the engagements with the department and, under Minister Patel and the entities. And we are aligned in terms of what we are doing and in terms of the support that you can expect from National Treasury in supporting the process and, you know, in this case, just making money available. As the presentation clearly states that we had to augment what the department has been doing and the reprioritization that they did, including support coming from NEF and IDC. So we are quite comfortable that this is ongoing and that the support needed will be made. I'm with Cedric here, the CEO of SASRIA, and we have just simply been asked to just maybe present this as our members would know that SASRIA is an entity within the National Treasury. It's one of our entities, so I'm not going to attempt to even make this presentation, but Cedric is going to lead the presentation and also to maybe confirm to the committee to say that we did, as part of the support package announced by the president some time ago, that we are behind, SASRIA, and we fully committed to SASRIA meeting its obligations in the challenges that the country faced a few weeks ago in supporting businesses that were affected. So we stood ready, and we did at the time indicated that an amount of 3.9 billion rand will be made available to ensure that Sasria, you know, financial position is stronger in them fulfilling the mandate and in supporting the business. So what Cedric has, we did go to our committee a few weeks ago, and with the presentation that we are going to make, we have updated with some latest numbers, of course, but we will then, you know, as soon as Cedric engages with the committee and presents to the committee, we'll be more than happy to raise comments. Again, I must just make apologies, Chair, to the minister who could not make the meeting, and I hope the apology did come through to the department, I mean, through to the secretariat of the committee, and then apologies for that. Chair, with your permission, maybe let me, you know, request Cedric Masondo to take the committee through the presentation of that we have prepared. Thank you very much, Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Masondo, and we did receive the apology from the Minister. Thank you very much, DG. CEO Masondo.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning to the honourable members, and also to the guests from DTIC. Chair, I've got a presentation. I'm not sure whether they can screen it for me, and then I will just go through the presentation that was sent yesterday.
Thanks, Cabot. I'm sure you.
Chair, we would advise that Ms. Masondo will be okay with Margaret. We'll fight it. Fine. No problem, Chair.
Yes, good. Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair. Last time I tried to present, and I was struggling with technology, so that's why I've resorted to us people who are better than me in terms of technology. So
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair, and for the invitation. And Sasria, it's quite a small company, and our contribution to the rebuilding of the economy. I think it's quite important. So, just brief history of Sasria. Prior 1979, this type of peril was included in a normal Sasria, in a normal fire policy. So, but after the 19 Soweto uprising, insurance companies refused to write this type of business. And then it created a gap in the market, Chair, where the people who had assets find themselves uninsured. Move to the next slide. So, and that's how Sasria was formed. It was formed at that time as a Section 21 company, and the purpose at that time was mainly to cover political rights. So any damage, I mean, caused by, that can be changed to be caused by political riots was covered by Sasria, and it was also, it became a pool, and the way it operates on a tariff system, and on the basis of non-refusable and non-cancelable, and also to make the cover affordable. And I think that we've lived with that principle that we don't cancel cover, we don't refuse cover, and we try by all means to make our product affordable. And we're a pool company. And if you go to the next slide, so, but after that, the mandate of Sasria was extended, and we became, and in 1989, we became a state-owned company, a 3B company, reporting to National Treasurer, and we're no longer just covering the political perils, we're also covering non-political perils. And because the reinsurance was also available in the international reinsurance after 1994, Sasria was able to buy reinsurance in an open market. So hence, that's why the government guarantee that was existing since 1979 was no longer necessary. So we've been buying reinsurance in the open market, and we buy reinsurance based on our capacity, on our risk appetite, but also what's happening in the country. To go to the mandate, Chair, our mandate is quite simple, is to make sure that we provide this affordable short-term insurance. We are part of, so our product is part of an insurance product. So when somebody buys fire policy or a motor, and the client will be asked whether you want Sasria, and if the client wants Sasria, and Sasria is added in. So insurance companies do not provide this cover. So we work together with insurance companies, and we complement, we don't compete with insurance company, but we complement this insurance insurance companies to provide this cover. So we're a state-owned company, and I've said, and our main goal is to make sure that this is quite a difficult peril that insurance companies do not want to underwrite, that we provide this cover so that we can provide stability and make sure that there's development and growth in the economy. If we move to the next slide, these are the perils that we cover. So, as I've said, in 1989, our perils were extended. So we are now providing cover for terrorism, political violence, strikes, and riots. So the July events, Chair, will regard as riots, and in the legal way they will call it civil commotion. So these are events that just happens, and there's no political motive, so we can't classify as political violence. So we classify them as riots, and that's what happened in July. So this is what we cover, and insurance companies do not provide cover for this. And especially the terrorism, this is a common trend all over the world, that this is not provided by a traditional insurance company. Companies all over the world and countries have created pools that provide terrorism. And the main reason is because it's quite difficult to model this thing, this type of peril. And when it happens, it's big. And insurance companies don't want to underwrite something that is unpredictable and that's very difficult to model. And also, you can go for years without having an event, and then when the event happens, and it's big. So pricing becomes a bit difficult. You can't charge it at a high rate because people won't buy it because they want to feel that there's a need for it. So this is SASJA, and this is what we cover. And if you could move to the next slide. And we always understood from the beginning that our mandate is not just what is written in the Act, which is to provide insurance for those perils that I've talked about. So, I mean, our mandate is to make sure that when these things happen, jobs are not lost, and we instill confidence to the investors because, I mean, if there's insurance, people invest because they know that if something happened to them, they are product, they are damaged properties will be repaired and restored. And we've also played a very big role in developing this, especially in the financial sector. We are investing our profits and investing in infrastructure, and we also understand that transformation is quite a big issue for us. Move to the next slide. So this is our business model. We don't deal direct with insurance with clients, agent companies, or short-term insurance companies are our agents. And this model has worked for years, since 1979, because it means that we can maintain a lean structure in our business, and we can work together with insurance companies and not duplicate work. So I've mentioned that when you buy a policy, you only buy one policy. There's no such policy. You buy one policy, we follow the terms and the conditions of the underlying policy, which is a policy that will be issued by the insurance company. And we pay them a fee for doing that. So they do a lot of administration. They also do underwriting on our behalf. They collect premium. And then they forward the premium to us when there's a claim. They are the first stop of looking at the claims. And if they believe that it's our claim, they will forward the claims to us. And that's the only time where we deal with the client when there's a claim situation. I mean, if you look at prior to July event, we were a 10 billion company in terms of the assets. And we were making, I mean, the profit that we made in the last year, which we released, was about just 1.5 billion. That profit, and we're making that gross written premium of just under 3 billion, and that was based only on about 130 people. So the model is working, and of course, in times like this, you need to review the model because we needed to increase the capacity of the team, and that model helps for us to reduce cost. And when you reduce cost, it means that our product becomes affordable. And we must have a strong relationship with the agent companies because they do a lot of work on our behalf and they sell our product. Although that does have shortcoming because that means that our selling strategy, our sale and our trend of writing premium, it's directly linked to the strategy of insurance companies. But it's something that we work on that now we can, in some cases, use different distribution channels to reach. If you can move to the next slide. So we are a special risk insurer, and as I've said, we don't refuse cover, we don't cancel cover. And during July, we were just in the middle of this crisis, we did not cancel cover. We're still writing business. We're still encouraging people to buy Sazia. Of course, we wouldn't pay prim claims that happen for people to buy Sazia. And that's something we've done for the past years, that when there's riots, and just in the middle of that, we encourage people to buy Sazia. And this is different to what most insurance companies will do. When the risk is visible, most insurance companies will stop writing that business. So we have not stopped writing business. We still write Sazia, and we're still encouraging people to write Sazia. We are the only insurance company that will pick up these claims resulting in July. And that when you buy a policy, the normal policy will exclude Sazia perils, and the only way you can have it is to buy it back. And we work on a tariff basis, so it means that we have one rate for all insurance in the same class. And that really helps in terms of the cost and also in terms of the business, that we don't penalize a client for being multi-claimant. But we also make sure that charge, really our focus is to make sure that our rates are affordable. That's what we've been trying for years, that how do we make sure that our rates are affordable. But of course, the SME and the big corporate pays very different rates, and mainly because of the exposure. The SME will have lesser exposure, the big corporate will have a higher exposure. Move to the next slide. And this is type of product that we write. We write anything that is assets, material, damage, and that's normally some people call it fire classes, that will include the structure of the building, the fittings and the fixtures, and in the case of a retail, that would also include the stock, money, goods in transit, business interruption, that's a big component for claims, and construction. This is claim when there's building going on, and we provide cover for the construction until the building is finished and it's handed over. Once the building is finished and it's handed over, then the client will have to buy a material damage policy. Of course, we also buy motor. So I also want just to highlight that one of the areas that have been of concern to us in the last 3 years is the damages to trucks. So we've seen that trucks have been looted, and just one incident in Moy River a couple of years ago, we lost about 75 million just because of trucks. It's one area that has been a big concern for us, that trucks are being damaged and goods being looted, and in some cases even drivers being killed. So these are our product range, and the client of course will have to decide what they want to buy and what they don't want to buy, but also the limits what we need to buy. And if you move to the next slide.
We were actually thinking we shouldn't steal too much of your time. Maybe in the next 5-10 minutes we can round up.
Okay, yeah. Perfect. So if we can just move to the slides. This is just our industries, Jeff. These are our clients. I don't have to talk much. I wanted just to spend 5 minutes on this one, the damages. So I think for us, it's quite, and as early as Monday, it was clear these are Sazia perils, and we went to the media and confirmed these claims will be paid by Sazia. And after getting a bigger note, and that's been confirmed that this is Sazia claims. Dondo has mentioned that we did during that week when looting was going on and we didn't know what the damage is, we started discussing with National Treasurer and we're all exploring all scenarios and we were preparing for the worst case scenario. Worst case scenario being where the damages exceeds our balance sheet, exceeds our reserves, but also exceed our reinsurance recovery. So, and I'm glad those discussions have gone well, and the minister injected or soon be injecting about 3.9 billion as part of capital injection to make sure that we continue to pay claims and honor those valid claims. So, if you can move to the next slide, just talking at the next one. So. And the next one. I mean, the team before did confirm that about 70% of the claims are from KZN, and this is also our view. And I think I must qualify the last part. We expect the claims to be between 15 and 20 billion, probably about around 20 billion. But these are such a claim. These are not total property loss. So Saja claims, Saja issue a cover up to 500 million, and then we also have a 1 billion cover. So the claims that will fall into the 500 million coupon, what we call 500 million coupon, as we said, now we've received about 17 billion, and our projection is that that number might go up to about 20 billion in the next couple of months. We have, if you can move to the next slide, we have captured almost more than 95% of the claims, and also we have the 18 billion. It's based on the 95% claim that we've captured, but it's also based on the estimates that we've received from the loss adjuster. So we're quite comfortable, Chair, that the figure of 20 billion it seems to be probable for us based on our exposure. Of course, there are people that defy Saja. There are people that will have losses beyond the Saja limit. But in our view, that this figure of about 20 billion seems probable based on what we've seen. So and these are the estimates by the loss adjusters. Of course, the estimates go up and down. And we'll only know in maybe 12 months' time the real number once we've paid the last claim. Our view is that... And what we also see is that big claims tend to be big contributors in terms of the claim value. And I've indicated about 50 claims have contributed more than 10 billion in terms of value. And the rest is about 7,000 have contributed 8 billion. And our target is to make sure that claims below 50 million are settled within 4 months and claims above 60 million will take longer because those will be the claims relating to reconstruction of building and so on. And if we move to the next slide, I think that's my last slide. And I wanted to continue in the interest of time. I can stop here. But I think the future for us just is to make sure that we pay all valid claims. And that's what we're committed. And we're also happy that National Treasurer as a shareholder is supporting us. Our views also, our commitment is also to rebuild, as I've indicated, these losses have wiped out the reserves and the work of years. In 2 days, our reserve and our capital was built. But our commitment is to rebuild Saja because we believe that it's quite an important institution that needs to exist. And of course, we want to rebuild Saja so that it becomes a bigger organization that play a meaningful role in the Saja in special perils. Chair, in the interest of time, and I will stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, CEO. I think we can just check if ever there are no clarification questions from members. And I think we really appreciate that we were able to steal your time for you to join us. We do have a better understanding of Sazria now. And honorable members, are there any comments or questions? been accepting the report from SARS-RIA, the Treasury entity. And if not, Secretary, I'm sure we can actually then proceed to actually then thank the presentation. DG, one will actually then go back to you for the concluding remarks and be able to actually conclude the presentation. DG?
Thank you very much, Chair. No, I think Chair will take guidance from you. We are fine. We've presented what we thought would be necessary at this point in time, but we'll be more than happy in future, Chair, once we've forged closer collaborations with the Department of Trade and Industry and Cooperation on these matters. We'll be more than willing to come to you at any given point in time if any point will be needed. So thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to interact with this committee. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, DG. Most welcome. We would actually then actually ask, allow you to actually then proceed with the rest of the day. And Secretary, I'm sure we can pick up on the next item. Thanks to DG Treasury Dodo Mohajane. And thank you to our CEO of SARS-RIA, Cedric Masondo. Most appreciated for the time spent with us. Thank you. Can you take the last item then, Secretariat, from our agenda? Sorry to the honorable members that we late. And can we then just pick up on the last item on our agenda around the program? Secretariat, if you can just fly it and take us through so that you can highlight the areas that we need to resolve on. Secretariat.
Thank you, Chairperson. We have an amended program which aligns to the new parliamentary framework that was given to us, Chair. Chair, the initial change that we have is that the Friday, originally we had a meeting scheduled for Friday the 27th, Chair. There's a women's parliament scheduled for the day, so that with the instruction of the House Chairperson, we have to remove from our program, Chair. So that meeting has shifted to the 31st of August, Chair. So we will get our first response from DTIC and added from the Merwe on the submissions with respect to the public hearings we had on the Copyright and Performance Protection Amendment Bills, Chair. Then we schedule deliberations from 1st, 7th, 8th. We're going up until, if we can just can go down. The 14th, Chair. Chair, then the other change is that we move the briefing by the DTIC to the 21st of September, Chair, and then and the master plan is now being scheduled for the 28th of September, and then the program includes the completion of the BRRR report, Chair, which we hopefully will adopt on the 5th of October. And the program of Parliament, the framework that was given, goes until, if Malcolm just go down, until the 12th of October. So those were additions to the program. The original program that we submitted last week, Chair, or the week before, went up to the 1st of October. It's now been extended to the 12th of October to conclude the budget review process, Chair. So those are there's no significant changes. It's just shifting of some agenda items to other dates that will accommodate all the requests that we receive from DTIC as well as the request from the House Chairperson to not to proceed on the 27th of August to accommodate the Women's Parliament that is scheduled for that day. Other than that, Chair, there's no significant change to the program. It was just about shifting dates to accommodate those requests, Chair. We just want the committee to look at it and also basically approve the program so that we can forward. Chair, just another reminder, the parliamentary framework is not finalized. It seems to be in flux. So if there are any further changes, we will inform the committee of that, Chair, as soon as we receive it.
Can I maybe to the committee just say, let's actually look at what has been suggested is an amendment of dates. Maybe on my part, what I would really suggest that what we will do, we'll circulate this to all the members. But for our meeting today, it's actually being able to actually agree and acknowledge and accept the changes, because it's something out of our control as the committee, the parliamentary program, that impacts on our program. But the content and issues we have in our program still remains and are actually issues that we are able to deal with. Honorable members, can I actually get your comments? I'm sure we can be able to agree to, you know, make those dates amendment. We will then circulate after the meeting the program to all of us so that we can check our diaries, so that we don't end up with actually being excluded on the basis of the changes. But this one is for today, and it's actually the one that we actually will circulate, and I'm sure some of you have looked at it. Are there any comments from members? And if ever there are comments, can we take them now? If ever there are no comments, can we then take it as agreed that we are going to actually use the dates and times we have before us on the program of issues that we have agreed upon as a committee? Can I invite members? Honourable members.
Chair, there's no hands. Chair, we may proceed.
So, which means obviously then we can proceed.
Mr. Mbuyane, Chair, just raise his hand. My apologies.
Honourable Mbuyane.
Chairperson, thanks for the opportunity. I don't know as to whether we need to agree on a program or the proposed program or just an update for the committee. Thanks.
Chair, the principle is to agree to the program because there is some changes in terms of data that the committee is in support of the program, Chair. So if we can have a move and a second, that will be useful, Chair.
Okay. So which means we will then actually have to accept it, Honourable Mbuyane.
Oh, Chairperson, thank you. If that is the case, Chairperson, I'll move that we adopt the newly corrected program for the PC. Thank you.
Okay. Amended program agreed to, moved by Honorable Mbuyane. Do we have a seconder? Honorable members? Can I get a seconder to Mbuyane for acceptance of the program before us?
Mutahum, Chair.
Honorable Mutahum.
Thanks, Chair. I second the adoption of the program.
Are there any objections? In the absence of objections, I think we would say the program is agreed to. So I think, Secretary, then let's speak to the next issue so that at least we are able to conclude our meeting.
Chair,
yes.
We have concluded the agenda, Chair, just to inform members that tomorrow we will have a briefing by SAPS and NRCS. They will provide an update on the turnaround strategies, Chair, starting at 9 o'clock.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I'm sure we've come to a conclusion. Thousand apologies for being late in terms of our meeting. Can we actually then conclude, and can I actually indicate that the meeting is adjourned? Thank you very much.
Long live the chairperson. Long live the chair.
Good job.